All right.
Nick!
Gentlemen!
Nick's your buddy. Kind of guy you can drink a beer with.
Start your engine!
My papa's son wandering out a smoking gun. Now some of you would live through me and lock me up and throw away the key, or just find a place to hide away and hope that I'll just go away, huh. But I feel alright, I feel alright tonight.
All right. Good morning, everybody. How you doing? Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio in downtown Chicago, and we're here till 5 a.m. It is Thursday. That means Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. So get those in. Coming up on the show, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us in just a few minutes. He is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine. He is a space specialist. He's written 950 books, approximately, and he is a speaker, and we love to talk space stories with him. Lots of stuff happening. We want to get him into here. And if you guys have any questions or comments about space-related issues or questions, it's 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. Rod's going to join us in just a few minutes. So that's coming up. Also, after we talk with Rod, we're going to talk with two members of the band called Start Making Sense. They're considered like the best Talking Heads tribute band. And they're playing two shows at Martyrs here in Chicago on Lincoln Avenue. They're playing Friday the 17th and Saturday the 18th. And they put on a fantastic Talking Heads tribute show. So if you're a fan of Talking Heads, you might want to check these guys out this weekend. And we'll talk to two members from the band Start Making Sense. That's coming up. Yesterday marked the fourth anniversary of the release of, one of my favorite movies that's ever been made. And that's Mad Max Fury Road. So we're going to talk a little bit about post-apocalyptic movies, which is one of my favorite genres, actually. And then also some product placement, the use of product placement, which has been going on for so many, many years. And we'll jump into that topic. And the phone lines and text lines are always open at 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200 for talk and text and your Triple Play Thursday requests. Yeah, and you can follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show. And stay connected with us on our Facebook page, which is updated and interactive during the show while the show is happening. And that is Facebook.com/Nick D Show. Facebook.com/Nick D Show. So, you can also, you should subscribe to our podcast. It's a great way to listen to the show if you can't be awake between 1 and 5 a.m. Every single second of every single show is podcast and is available. So you can subscribe, go to iTunes, wherever you get your podcast, subscribe to the Nick D Show podcast. It's free, and it will be automatically sent to your device, and you can listen at your leisure, bro. So there you go. There's all the connections and all the ways to listen to the show, and there you are. So let me say hello to Tom Hush, my great producer. Tom, how are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah?
Yeah, just, you know, it's weird to think that already we're 4 years out of Fury Road.
Yeah, I know.
And I will say, I saw this, it was last month. The website World of Real did a critics poll of the best movies of the decade, you know, as they got a jump on it because we're going to be reaching the 2020s soon.
Well, yeah, it's at the end of this year, we've got another decade list. I got another decade list to do.
Huge decade list.
Yeah.
So for them, their critics poll listed Mad Max Fury Road as the best film of the 2010s.
Well, that's because it is.
Yeah.
that's why it's listed as the best film of the 10s, because
they're just speaking the truth, Nick.
It is, and kind of by far the best film. And it's been a really good decade. There's been a lot of great films came out from 2010 till the end of this year.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be a fun list to put together. But I mean, it's not going to be a surprise to see what's number one on my list when I make it. It's going to be Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah, we're teasing for December.
Come back in December so that you can hear what I'm saying now, because it's Mad Max Fury Road is the best movie of the past decade.
For 2 through 9.
Yeah. So that's we're coming up post-apocalyptic. I love post-apocalyptic movies.
Oh, it's a great genre.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites. So we're going to have a lot of fun with that. Talk about that later. Product placement is hilarious, too. I have one of my favorite product placement stories is in the movie Leonard Part 6. Are you familiar with Leonard Part 6?
I am not.
Leonard Part 6 is this notoriously horrible Bill Cosby movie that came out in the 80s. Even he said, don't see it. And Bill Cosby's made some bad movies. Ghost Dad comes to mind immediately. But Leonard Part 6 is absolutely notorious for just how bad it is. And one of the most ridiculous product placement things, of course, they do, you know, they do a Coca-Cola and a Jell-O pudding. They do that in the movie because that he was most closely related with that. But there is an unbelievably ridiculous product placement moment in that movie. I'll tell you guys about it later when we jump into the product placement. That, you know, there's a lot of incredible examples of product placement. Back to the Future is a virtual minefield of product placement.
That it is.
Some of them are creative and some of them are fun. Like, you know, Back to the Future, I want a Pepsi free. Hey, if you want a Pepsi, you're going to have to pay for it, pal.
Yeah.
All right, well, then give me a tab. I can't give you a tab unless you order something. Just give me something with no sugar in it. He gives him a cup of coffee. So that was clever. And it, you know, there were two brand names that were thrown in there. And Pepsi is, you know, obviously Michael J. Fox was associated with Pepsi. So that's another layer of comedy right there. But this moment in Leonard Part 6 is ridiculous. I'll tell you about it later on. And that movie, oh my God, is that movie bad. So, so bad. So anyway, all that's coming up. Let's get into the newsroom, and it's Vic Vaughn. Hi, Vic.
Morning, sir.
Morning. Hey, so you got to see a little bit of last night's game, which is unfortunate.
Well, it's looking good when I woke up. I can't believe the game was still on again. I mean,
yeah.
I think I woke up at 8:30, so...
Yeah, it was a 5:40 first pitch, and it ended close to 9.
Yep. So I ran out and said, Genie, change Law and Order, put on the Cubs game. And then I saw
them. And then you said, okay, I should have stayed with Law and Order.
Yeah, exactly.
That ending. It was a very disappointing ending. The Cubs ended up losing. But they can't win every game. I'm just concerned a little bit about the bullpen because Darvish pitched really well tonight. It was the first game that he pitched, like, exceptionally well.
Yeah,
11 strikeouts, no walks.
Yeah, I mean, that's great.
It's great. I mean, they took him out because of a high pitch count. But it was clearly his best start, and the bullpen blew it.
Yasiel Puig licking his bat, at the chops, couldn't wait.
Yeah. Well, all right. Well, they're back tonight. We can see him again tonight. Is it a 5:40 game again?
5:40 again. Yeah.
Okay, cool. So we'll see if the Cubs can take that series.
That series.
Yeah, it's tied at 1 right now. And then they play Walgreens this weekend.
Took me a second.
I always love to call Washington. I was going to say the Washington Senators. What am I, 75 years old? Jeez. No, the Nationals. That's what they're called. Now they're not called the Senators anymore.
Senators.
But yeah, so I like it when they play the team from Walgreens. So they're going to play Walgreens over the weekend. The logo's exactly the same.
It's shocking. It's
ridiculous. I remember when they unveiled those uniforms, I was like, wait a minute, hold on. That's the Walgreens W. Are you aware that there's like maybe just a little teeny difference between the two? If you put the two logos next to each other, it's like, oh.
It's one of those moments where you go, somebody didn't think that.
Right, exactly.
Well, at least now you can get your baseball and your prescription medicines at one stop.
Yeah, exactly. They got the guys who actually are on the team have to fill the prescriptions. They get trained, and they have to fill the prescriptions. So, that's happening this weekend. We got some baseball coming up tonight and over the weekend. But right now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, our good friend Rod Pyle is going to join us. If you have any space-related questions of any kind, he's the expert. 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 981-7200. And we'll talk to Rod Pyle about space right after we take this break. There's a star. Welcome, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Triple Play Thursday. Yeah! Triple Play Thursday, that means one artist, three songs. Get your requests in now. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. And we're going to be talking with two members of this the Talking Dead's tribute band, the Talking Heads tribute band, Start Making Sense. That's coming up. We're going to talk about great post-apocalyptic movies. It's a great genre in honor of the anniversary of the release of Mad Max Fury Road. And we're also going to talk about product placement and much more. Taking your phone calls and your texts at any time, 312-981-7200. And right now, if you have any questions, about space-related issues, outer space, 312-981-7200. Send them via text or call us right now because Rod Pyle is about to join us. He is author, a journalist, editor-in-chief at Ad Astra Magazine for the National Space Society, and the author of many, many, many books. He joins us usually once a month to talk space, lots of space stories to get to. And, of course, if you have any questions, text them or call us at 312-981-7200. Welcome back, Rod. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, not bad, sir. Well, welcome to the show again.
Thank you. You know, just this afternoon, I was trying to remember what movie it was that I wanted to watch before I spoke to you next time, and it was Fury Road, but I couldn't remember until you said it. And I said, that's it. I haven't seen that one yet.
You still haven't seen it?
No, isn't that pathetic?
Yeah, well, you got to see it. It's transcendent.
I think, you know, after Thunderdome, I just kind of got burnt on the whole thing. But
yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is, by all rights, the best thing since the first one, right?
Yeah, no, I think it's the best of the series. A lot of people go Road Warrior, Mad Max 2 Road Warrior, and I can't deny the genius of that movie, but I just think I think Fury Road just goes to places that I don't think I've ever been to cinematically. It's just it's an astonishing piece of work. It really is. And I tell you, Rod, when it opened 4 years ago yesterday. And I saw it when the weekend opened. I saw it three times in 24 hours. So I'm not kidding.
I know people that did that with that Apollo 11 documentary that came out a couple months ago.
Yeah.
Just went, like, they left the theater and got right back in line to see it again. I just watched Oblivion for the first time, which was a lot better than I had expected.
Yeah, what did you think?
What did you think of that?
I loved it. And I
did too. And it got all this bad press, and I thought, you know, you guys aren't being fair.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't the kind of movie you're expecting, but I thought it was beautifully crafted. It was just stunning to watch.
Yeah.
And I wish I had seen it in the theater. It was clever.
Yeah. And not only that, the last 15 minutes of that movie is as freaky as a movie can be.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they really pull out the rug from under you about three times.
Yeah.
A little bit like James Cameron, where you think, oh, it's over now. Oh, wait, no, it's not.
Wait, it's not. Yeah,
is it
exactly.
Over now? No,
yeah.
It's not.
No, it's not. Yeah. All right, very cool. So you saw that. Now, you mentioned, did you see the Apollo? Because the last time we were on, you hadn't seen the documentary yet.
Yeah, I've been trying. I'm working on an issue of the magazine I edit that it kind of got a little out of control for me. It's normally about 40 pages. This one, it was an Apollo 11 tribute edition that's coming out in June.
Yeah.
And it's 100 pages because I just couldn't
stop. Yeah.
So it's got augmented reality and all this other stuff. So I got all caught up in that. But I did finally go see the Apollo movie. And, you know, I had heard that they had found some 70 millimeter footage, which was, that's a unicorn in the space race era.
Yeah.
Because there, you know, as far as we knew, there wasn't any. It was all 16 millimeter. And I remember, I don't think I told this story in the show before, but I was talking to the director of communications for NASA back in the 80s, a guy named Brian Duff, who was, you know, one of the gods there.
Yeah.
And he was kind enough to give nervous, goofy little me a meeting because I wanted to make a NASA documentary. And so we chatted for about, you know, he gave me like half an hour. He's the nicest guy.
Oh.
And I said, is there anything bigger than 16 millimeter film of the Apollo years? And he said, see that corner right there? I said, yeah. He said, I had a stack 3 feet high of 35 millimeter foam cans. Maybe he meant 70. I don't know. That sat there for 8 years.
Oh.
And I couldn't get money to get it processed, so I set it into the shredder.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if maybe that's the stuff that went, instead of getting shredded, sat in the archives, because my understanding is they pulled it, processed it now, still looks good. And if you saw it in the theater, it was breathtaking.
Yeah.
How clear that was. I mean, it looked like it was shot last week in 8K or something.
Wow.
So that was... You know, I didn't break down and sob or anything. I got a little lump in my throat.
Sure,
but
you did.
I did hear that a lot of people that saw the movie with their kids or their friends who knew really nothing about the program, that a lot of the people that weren't indoctrinated this were much more moved than the people that were old enough to remember it.
Yeah.
And that a lot of them left the theater with tears running down their faces. And I thought, that's the kind of salesmanship the NASA needs right now.
Absolutely.
So,
well, and you know
hallelujah.
What? And you know what? The movie made a lot of money for a documentary not shown in a ton of theaters. And so there was a very enthusiastic audience for that film.
Well, and so there's another one coming out, which I only mentioned because I consulted on it. So, of course, I have to mention it.
Yeah.
The National Geographic did kind of a similar fashion, no voiceover, you know, almost no cards, just all in the moment, which I thought was brilliantly done in the one I just saw.
Yeah.
And the Nat Geo one's coming out in early July, but it's the whole program, so it's Sputnik forward.
Oh,
to the
okay.
end of the Apollo hardware. So
okay.
that'll be another must-see, I think, and that's going to the theaters first and then TV, I guess.
Good. Very cool. Rod, hang on. We got a break. Rod Pyle is with us. He is our space expert, author of 14,000 books, approximately. He is a journalist, a speaker, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and our favorite space expert. And if you have any space-related questions, outer space-related questions, it's 312-981-7200. Rod would be happy to answer them for you, and we've got some news stories to talk about as well. All right, we'll take a break. The news is coming up right after this. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline Studio, 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Year. Get those requests in. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. That is also the number to text to or to call with any and all space and outer space-related questions, because Rod Pyle is our guest. He's an author and journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and he joins us usually once a month or so to talk space. And let's welcome Rod back to the show. Hello, Rod.
Hello, sir.
Hey.
So what's our first topic?
We got a couple of calls that are that have come in. We'll get those, and then we'll jump into some of the news stories that you wanted to talk about, that we want to talk about as well. But first, let's talk to Joe. Hey, Joe.
Hey, Nick. A real easy question for Rod, being facetious, of course. What do we know that it would allow us to gauge whether there's a potential for finding any precious metals within our reach? You know, the moon, you know, planets, whatever, gold, platinum scenario.
That kind of stuff. All right, go ahead, Rod.
Yeah. So on the moon, nothing of any amounts has been found of that kind of thing that I know of. I mean, we have lots of rocks back in the moon, almost 1,000 pounds of them. So we know there's a lot of oxygen in the rocks, which is more valuable than a lot of precious metals because they're already in space. So you don't have to launch them up there. So that's worth quite a bit of money. There's a lot of glass. There's some metals, but as far as I know, none of those. It is strongly expected that they're going to be in a lot of the asteroids, though. Like tons of platinum in any given medium-sized asteroid, and a lot of rare earth elements, which, of course, China has a lock on because most of them are in Asia. So we're really looking forward to those. The problem is, you know, there's just two things. I was talking to, I think I mentioned this on the show last time, Steve Jurvetson, this billionaire space investor
yeah.
who put money in SpaceX in 2008 when they really needed it and so forth. And I was interviewing him for a book, and I said, you know, if you bring this enormous platinum-rich asteroid down to Earth and start pulling the stuff out of it, what happens to the markets? And he said, well, of course, you know, if there's that much in there, you know, you can throttle the amount of it a little bit, but it's just going to depress the prices. And you wiped out the better part of Australia just to bring this large meteorite down so that you can mine it. So, because that was his suggestion, is bring it down the outback, which sounds a little extreme. So, you know, the problem is it worth something up there as a precious metal? No. Is it worth something as a metal that you can use in construction fabrication? Sure. But bringing it to Earth is expensive and dangerous. And last thing I'll say is, you know, you want to be very certain you trust whoever's deorbiting that stuff, because it's a big hunk of rock and metal.
Yeah,
and
if
you set it down in the wrong neighborhood, it could be a very bad day.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Joe, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe.
All right, 815 area code sends a text that says, the solar eclipse that was viewable in Illinois in August 2017 moved from west to east, but the sun moves from east to west. Why west to east? I can't explain it.
Let's see. Is that right? I was in Oregon for that. That was when I was in Oregon, I think, for it. It was in beautiful Prineville, Oregon. And it came sweeping across the... I went into astronomy at UCLA when I was 20.
Yeah.
And I lasted a year and 2 months because I discovered that they wanted me to learn... They had the audacity to ask me to learn differential calculus. And differential calculus, and I didn't get along. So I'm not sure I can answer that. I don't remember that being the case. I thought it went the other way. I wonder if he has his compass points right.
You mentioned, by the way, well, Rod, first of all, everybody, we forgot to do the monthly introduction that you always do. You can just introduce yourself. Okay. We're a little late on that, but go ahead and throw that out there.
Aren't you bored yet?
No, of course not.
Oh, well, I've written, what did you say, 14,000?
That, approximately.
Yeah, so you're close. You just lost by a few zeros. So I think I'm up to 15 now.
Okay.
I'm slowing down a little bit this year because of the magazine. But I was born right around the same time the space age started and grew up watching and really being thrilled by all that stuff. And my parents had enough foresight to let me stay home from school and watch the moonwalks and they were going on. So I just ate it up and got really excited, read all the old Von Braun books and all the big golden books of space with their banana-shaped silver rockets and everything. And, I thought I wanted to do engineering and science until I had my Waterloo at UCLA. And then I realized, no, what I really wanted to do all along, wink, wink, nudge, nudge,
yeah,
was communicate this stuff to the public. So I went to film school instead and then learned how to write and did TV commercials for a while and so forth. But I always had this real lust for space stuff. And after making some space documentaries, thought, I want to write books. And I got in just in time before the market turned to be much tougher for people to get in, at least with traditional publishers. So I was very fortunate that way. And the high point of all that is being on your show.
Oh, well, come on now. Well, we always love having you on, Rod. Let's talk about a few things that you sent to us. I love the headline that you put here. This is really comforting. Death from above.
Yeah.
What's that all about? It's about a giant asteroid that might smack into the Earth in about 8 years.
Well, that's very interesting because you just ate up what happened with this, like the public did. So NASA and FEMA and the European Space Agency and a bunch of other agencies got together for this planned exercise to game out what do we do if we see an asteroid that in, say, 8 years has a 1%, and then we study it more closely and we realize it's actually 10% chance of impacting the Earth. That's fairly large, 300 to 1,000 feet, not huge, not a city record, but certainly going to take out a good chunk of a town.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, actually, that would be a city record. I take that back. So they made up this fictitious scenario with an asteroid called, I think it was 2019 PDC or something, and they tweeted this out. And apparently ESA, the Europeans, tweeted it with a hashtag fictional event, but they didn't put it in all the tweets.
Oh,
so
no.
A bunch of people thought, oh, my God.
Oh, no.
So the subsequent tweet had hashtag impact scenario, which didn't quite convey the fictitious nature of it. So people started getting flipped out. Bottom line was it was completely fictional. But, that said, don't take too much comfort because there's more than 900 rocks of a good size whizzing around our neighborhood. They're called near-Earth objects all the time.
Yeah.
And, they track as many of them as they can, but we don't know where they all are. We didn't know that the Chelyabinsk meteor was coming over Russia a few years ago until it was coming in. And that was, the size of a small nuclear weapon in terms of the energy released. So the lesson here is be more careful with your tweets. Are you listening?
Yeah.
Mr. President, Mr. Musk. And, it's good they're planning for this. And Obama, during the Obama administration in 2010, upped the budget for observing and studying and beginning to plan for this kind of a scenario by a factor of 10.
Mm-hmm.
And they're still looking for more money because first you got to spot them, then you got to figure out what direction they're headed and what the chances of intersecting with Earth are. And then you got to start testing the technology to nudge these things out of the way. And that's, we've talked before about the DART mission that's going up in 2023. it stands for double asteroid redirect impactor or something.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's a smallish spacecraft that's going to go slam into a small asteroid that's orbiting another one. It's a little moon called Diddy Moon, and the asteroid's called Didymus. And it's going to slam into that, and we're going to see how much it nudges it. And if we can figure out how to change the direction of these things, if you get them early enough, which is where the observation part comes in, then you can nudge them off course without having to do too much dramatic stuff. You don't have to send up, you know, the space cowboys and their nuclear bombs to get rid of them.
Right. So now, what were some of the results of these scenarios that they've been testing?
I haven't seen anything yet.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they've been studying this for a long, long time, and we know there are various ways of doing it. One is putting rocket motors or some form of locomotion on it to get it to move off course. One of the extreme ones is painting one side of it white so that, because of the thermal differential, it would cause a little bit of thrust and knock it off course. The Russians, of course, came up with what is going to be all our favorites, which is let's use all those nuclear warheads we have sitting around that we didn't flatten the Americans with in the Cold War. And rather than blowing it up, though, they would set them off next to it. And again, the energy would just heat up on one side. And that gives a little bit of force and pushes it off course. So that's a preferred way to do it because blowing up a big rock is a lot harder than it looks.
Yeah, even with Bruce Willis and Ben Affleck involved.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was going to ask, what's the probability of a team of drillers getting up there?
Yeah, right.
Well, and you know, one of the problems is this, because it's something, I hate to go off on a tangent, but I'll do it anyway. I was writing a book at JPL last year. I do it every couple of years. It's about all their newest projects. One of the really interesting projects was, you know, if you're going to nudge up against an asteroid, how do you latch on? You know, you can use anchoring bolts. You can use the stuff we've seen the Japanese and the European probes try to do. This guy came up with a thing called Gecko Gripper, which looks almost like a starfish on a post, but it's got all these little filaments on it. They're angled back, so these fingers just kind of reach out and touch down. And it can hold much more forcibly than even anchors and toggle bolts. And it does eventually drill in to be permanent. So the initial grip is just with this little kind of gecko-y hand. It's the same thing a gecko uses to walk on walls and ceilings. Mm. So they've got some really cool ideas, but it's all in the research stage at this point.
I see. All right. Before we break here, which one did you like better, Deep Impact or Armageddon?
I think Deep Impact.
Yeah, me too.
How about you?
Me too. Easily. Deep Impact is much better. Tom's shaking his head. Tom's shaking his head. You actually like Armageddon?
I adore Armageddon.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no.
Oh.
Oh, dear.
I've lost the respect of Rod Pyle.
God almighty.
Tom's the new guy. Yeah.
Tom's the new guy. That's right. All right, Rod, hang on, man. Hang on, Rod. We'll be back in a minute. All right.
Okay.
All right, there he is, Rod Pyle, everybody. I can't believe you like Armageddon. What other Michael Bay movies do you like so I can get this out in the open right now?
Bad Boys 1 and 2.
Oh, my God. God.
Pain and Gain's pretty cool.
Oh. Wow, man. I can't think of... Well, no, I like The Rock. That's it. Bad Boys 2 is one of the worst movies ever made. It's nothing but contempt for its audience, that movie.
I know. I love when he hates me.
2 hours and 40 minutes long. Oh, my God.
Spectacular.
God, he's the worst. All right. We're going to take a break. And more with Rod Pyle. Any space questions that you guys have? We got space news to get to, more of that. We'll talk a little bit about his latest book, which just came out a couple of weeks ago. And we'll tell you how you can get that and all those other details. Always fun to talk with Rod about space. 312-981-7200. Talk or text us right now. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio on a Thursday morning. Triple Play Thursday, get your requests in now. We'll play them later. It's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Coming up later on, we're going to talk with two members of the band Start Making Sense. They're a Talking Heads tribute band, and they got two gigs here in Chicago. We're going to talk about Talking Heads, their band, and the shows that they're doing this weekend at Martyrs right here. That's coming up, and also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Right now, let's get back to our conversation with our good friend Rod Pyle, who is a space expert, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra magazine, and author. And he joins us usually once a month to talk space stuff. And Rod, welcome back.
Thank you. So, eclipse question.
Yeah.
Because apparently I'm not an expert in astronomy. So I just looked it up during the break, and the simple version of the answer is that we're used to seeing the sun coming up in the east and setting in the west, so it's natural to assume the eclipse shadow did the same thing. But since the moon itself orbits Earth from west to east, that's the shadow track.
Ah, there you go.
So got compound motions here, yeah. Which should have been obvious.
Yeah, actually, I think we all should have got that one.
Well, I'm not saying anything.
Well, Tom wouldn't, because he likes Armageddon. So that's
well, and you liked Interstellar. So what am I?
I did like Interstellar. You know? I loved Interstellar. Yeah,
I know.
Pointing fingers over here.
I picked up that DVD again the other day, and I thought, am I ever going to watch this again? No, I got to keep it just because of Nick. So I put it back up on the shelf in observance of you.
Well, I appreciate that. All right, you send us another story, and again, you know when you send us these stories and you write them out and explain what's going on. I love your headlines. This is just simply called Exploding Dragons.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Oh, poor SpaceX. So, by the way, they were supposed to launch their first enormous load of broadband satellites tonight, but it got a weather hold, I guess, so it's going to go tomorrow. But you see the fairing of the Falcon 9 is just packed with, it looks like, 8-track tapes. And these are all these little repeater satellites that are going to be offering broadband over the planet. So that's pretty cool. But that's the good news. The bad news is, a few weeks ago, they were testing their Crew Dragon, which is their new space capsule that's supposed to be taking crews up the space station, we thought, within a matter of months.
Yeah.
So we finally would be able to stop buying rides from the Russians, since we don't have a space shuttle anymore.
Right.
So they were doing some testing at Cape Canaveral, and these people were filming it with their cell phone across the water. And there was this big kind of weird red cloud and then this bang noise. And so, of course, the video got on the web within minutes. Everybody's thinking, what's going on?
Yeah.
SpaceX going, well, we've had an anomaly, we're not saying. So they finally fessed up last week, a joint announcement with NASA. So apparently, they were testing first the maneuvering thrusters and then the abort rockets, which are called Super Draco engines. There's 8 on a total on the thing. And instead of having a rocket up top like Apollo used to have that would pull the capsule away from the booster in case it's malfunctioning,
right.
These are actually mounted on the side of the capsule. So apparently, just as they're getting ready to fire those, one of them exploded and the capsule was a total loss.
Mm.
So the good news is they've got a bunch of other Crew Dragon capsules on the assembly line in various stages of completion, so it won't put them back too much. The bad news is it makes astronauts really nervous when capsules and small rocket engines explode.
Sure.
Then, about the same time, a little bit later, the news came out that they were doing a parachute test at that same capsule in that same time frame, and the parachutes as a group didn't open properly, and it didn't destroy the capsule, but it hit really hard and probably would have been injurious. So they got a lot of work to do in a short period of time. They're supposed to be flying this summer.
Mm. And they've been having some problems pretty consistently, haven't they, at SpaceX?
Well, you know, it comes and goes. Yeah, they do have consistent challenges. I wouldn't call them problems all the time, because some of them are just the same things everybody else goes through. But they also make these incredible leaps, like the Falcon Heavy, which the guy designed, you know, out of check. He was writing out of his own checkbook.
Right.
So you kind of have to balance one with the other. Then on the other hand, you have Blue Origin, which is Jeff Bezos' rocket company, where you don't see these problems. I think he's lost one of his New Shepard rockets. But he's also not pushing as hard. You know, he's taking it much slower. They've actually been around longer than SpaceX by a couple of years, and they have yet to fly a large rocket. So, you know, 6 of 1, 12 of another. The thing is, you know, one thing that people in the trade talk about is SpaceX and Elon Musk, are they taking the same steps that NASA did? Because back in the space race, you know, if you picked up a screw from a Saturn V, Wernher von Braun had made sure that there were records for that screw all the way back to the mine.
Mm.
Where it was mined, you know, where they smelted it, where they made the screw, where it was inspected all the way through the supply chain to where they got it. And, you know, the new companies aren't doing that because they didn't think they had to, but I think there may be a little more of that required than we thought.
Mm, okay. And they do have to kind of assure NASA and the possible folks who are going to man these flights that these things are not going to blow up, so they're probably going to do more tests, right?
Yeah, I mean they got to man-rate these things and make them as safe as possible, and they're doing that. But these things are going to happen. We just don't like them to happen in such a large, visible way.
Yeah.
And we'd like to hear Well, that valve is leaking, which is what happened on the Boeing capsule a couple of months ago. We can deal with leaky valves, but when you start hearing about things exploding, that's a little more embarrassing. So they got a lot of work to do very quickly. I'm sure they'll get there. You know, we also had a couple of years ago one of his boosters blow up on the pad when they were fueling it. And because of the way he does this, you know, he puts the people in it and then gases it up instead of the other way around, which is what NASA always did. That makes people nervous, too. So, you know, it's just something that they got to work through.
Do they know? Because I know in the piece that you sent us, you wrote an unauthorized video of the explosion showed up on the web and prompted SpaceX to let its employees know that this is a fireable offense. Do they know who filmed it?
I don't think so, and I don't think it was an employee either. I think it was just somebody that saw it, but they did want to make sure they got the word out that we're a private company and we can do that. No video whistleblowers allowed.
But you figured, obviously, if someone's got their phone out or whatever, they're videoing it, or that it's obviously going to end up on the internet in two seconds.
Yeah, either for free or somebody's going to buy it. You know, there are a bunch of outlets that would buy that in a heartbeat for a good sum of money. So you bet it will.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't hide that kind of stuff. You know, big explosions are kind of tough. That's why it was so goofy. In Interstellar, when the Saturn V takes off, beginning and people wandering around going, a rocket took off. I didn't see anything. I thought, hold on a second. Those are hard to hide, you know. But visually, it was spectacular. I give you that. And the rest of the movie was perfect. It was just that one scene. Just that one thing. Well, and Matthew McConaughey, but other than that, well, and Matt Damon.
Well, we're never gonna agree on that, Rod. I gotta tell you, I still love that movie. It was my favorite movie of 2014.
And I love you, so we'll square.
All right. Well, I mean, look, you've written books about movies, and you've worked on movies and TV shows and stuff like that. So. That's why it's great to hear what's accurate and what isn't, because if anybody knows, it's you.
I didn't work in any good movies. I worked on some good TV shows. The movies were all kind of second rate. But yeah, it does give you some insights. And I was very fortunate, as I've said on your show before, to have gotten onto Trek and wanted to work on Star Trek for years. Finally got on Deep Space Nine, very ending of TNG.
Yeah.
It got on in that last gasp of using physical models, which was spectacular.
Yeah.
CGI is cool, but, you know, just for the experience of working with them, the miniatures are just like heaven.
I
was very fortunate.
CGI is fine and everything, and it's, you know, much easier to do, but I like the hands-on stuff. Currently my favorite animation studio is a studio called Laika. And they released a movie just a few weeks ago called Missing Link, and no one went to see it. And it's one of those stop motion movies where they have little clay characters.
Yeah.
Move an arm, take a picture, move an arm, take a frame. Takes four years to do those movies, and they look beautiful and natural. And I prefer that over any kind of computer or CGI stuff. So.
But it's like what Tim Burton was doing when he was doing his stop motion stuff.
Right.
When I was working in TV commercials, we had a stop motion guy in our studio. And I was watching him do a scene where it was raining, and he was moving little clear plastic beads down bits of monofilament about a quarter inch at a time between frames to make raindrops,
yeah.
And then putting little splats on the ground.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, that's craftsmanship. He's insane.
Absolutely.
That's craftsmanship.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. We're talking more space stuff, and if you have any questions, it's 312-981-7200. Let's get to the news right after this. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. I'm your overnight dude, 1 a.m. to 5 a.m. every weekday morning. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Get your requests in now. One artist, three songs. We'll play them later. 312-981-7200. 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call or to text us any and all space-related questions, because Rod Pyle is with us, and we're talking about some space news and space stories. And if you want to jump in with a question, 312-981-7200, and let's welcome Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. So
thanks for playing that intro music, by the way. I can't hear that now without thinking of that fairing opening up and that red Tesla road. What a moment that was.
It was great. It was great. And that was all over social media. That was just, it was insane. It was so cool to see, though. It was cool.
And very smartly done.
Yeah, agreed. All right, one other story that you wanted to, that also has a nice catchy headline. Bees in Space. I think I saw that on Cinemax once.
Yeah. I think I saw it on Saturday Night Live with John.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly.
Killer Bees in Space.
Yeah.
So these are not insects. They're little robots. There's been some experimenting with robots before on the space station. They had the International Space Station. They had Robonaut, which is this man-sized robot that had these weird articulated arms and legs that kind of bent the wrong direction. And the idea was, you know, that something the size of a human could interact with human tools and do human tasks. But they kind of, that sort of met a dead end. They're still working with it, but it hasn't done a lot in the last couple of years. So the new idea is these smaller drone-like robots called Astrobees. They're about the size of a small loaf of bread, and they got little fans in them and a little gripper claw, and they took a couple of them up to experiment with, and they're flying around the space station doing things. So the idea here is, besides just discovering if that kind of thing can be helpful, what they're looking for is a way to help take some of the workload off the astronauts, because the space station's been around for 20 years almost, and it's things are starting to go wrong. So the astronauts spend almost half their time on repair and maintenance, and they'll still have to do a lot of that. But the idea is, if you can get these robots to do some of the routine stuff, that would really be helpful, and they can work 24/7 without oversight because they're autonomous. So one of the early tasks they're assigning them to is to track down and find stuff that the astronauts let go of in the station and drifts away and, you know, goes behind a couch or something. And, it, you know, what happens then? You don't see it for 6 years. So these little robotic astronauts are going to go find things for them. So they're really, really very neat. And they've had enough success now that they're going to start setting up more of them.
What are the what are sort of the constant repairs that have to be done? What's gone wrong in the space station what about software? Has that been updated in the space station?
Yeah, oh, that's updated constantly, but they can do that from the ground. I think the stuff that is troublesome, especially that when they have to do EBAs, which are always dangerous when they go outside. You remember those big battery changes they were doing? And there are modules out there that go bad. And then there was a refrigeration problem, I think about a year and a half ago. So occasionally they'll actually get a gas or a fluid leak or something. Some are outside, some are inside. So there's a lot of stuff that just has to be patched up and retrofitted or replaced. And then things get updated. You know, there are power modules and so forth that they improve, and they'll fly an improved version of it up and swap it out. So that all takes a couple of astronauts and the robotic arm and time outside. And spacewalks have gotten pretty routine, but there's still something you got to do really carefully because it's easy to get banged up and hurt out there.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Well, hopefully these little Astro Bees will help them out. That would be great.
Yeah. Isn't that neat?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. Hey, let's talk a little bit about, really quickly before we get to another story, the NSS International Space Development Conference is June 5th through the 9th. It's in D.C. Tell us about that, and you're going to be there?
It is, and I am. So every year we have our conference that attracts anywhere from 1,000 to 1,500 people. And there's a bunch of pet tracks running parallel. So I think in the course of those 4 to 5 days, we have something like 120 speakers. So on the one hand, it's kind of overwhelming because you see all this stuff happening. But the great part is you can look at the program book and say, hey, I'm interested in orbital debris. I'm going to go to that. And then when that's done, I'm going to go to growing food in zero G. And then I'm going to go to that cool Apollo history talk that Pyle guy is giving, because I hear you might know something about that. And it's, you know, they're my crowd, but they're also, there's people from all walks of life there. There's a lot of young people. We get about 500 students every year. So there's from all over the planet. So a lot of them from the U.S., a lot from India, a lot from Asia. And, this is a cool place to go hang out with people that have this common interest at all different levels, everything from the man off the street who thinks it's kind of cool and decides he wants to join up and come see the conference, to we've got Jim Bridenstine, the chief of NASA, coming to give a talk, and a bunch of astronauts and a bunch of other really cool people. So it's quite an event. So, yes, you should come.
Is it always the same time? Is it always in June?
It's in May or June, and it moves around the country. So last year was in L.A., this year it's D.C., Arlington, actually. next year will be in Dallas, and the year after that it's back in L.A. So, you know, if you're willing to wait a couple of years, I'm sure we'll come back to Chicago.
All right.
Just for you, buddy.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate it. So that's the International Space Development Conference, June 5th through the 9th. There you go. Okay.
And website is isdc2019.nss.org.
There you go.
Thank you.
There you go. You got it. Okay. All right. The NASA wants to put a woman on the moon. And they've named it Artemis.
Is that cool or what?
That's the coolest.
Can you imagine when that came out? What did Andy Weir feel? Did you read his second book?
No.
So he wrote The Martian, and then they made the movie.
I saw the movie. I didn't read the book, but I saw the movie.
And life goes on. So the book was good. People loved it. I mean, it just sold like you can't believe, and the movie did great. Second book, I don't think sold as well, but it still did very well because it's Andy Weir.
You know, yeah.
He's a star writer now.
Yeah.
And it's about a colony on the moon called Artemis. And there's a young woman protagonist, and she's kind of a rough character, and she gets in some trouble and all this stuff. But he named it Artemis. And so here comes NASA saying, it's Apollo's sister. We had the Apollo program. Some nice connective tissue there. We'll call it Artemis.
Yeah.
And I bet he was beaming for days.
I would imagine.
So this is the back to the moon. We were going to do it by 2028, we hoped, with American astronauts. Now it's 2024. You know, by the end of perhaps Trump's second run, if there is one. And so what happened just a few days ago was NASA's sort of follow-up to Pence's announcement, saying a little more about how they're going to do it, who's going to be going. I thought it was very politically canny of them to say a man and a woman, because if the Democrats get sort of grumpy about this, it's a little harder to push back, you know. Mm-hmm. But well, you know, this is truly going above and beyond the glass ceiling, you guys. So give you a break. I don't think that's his whole motivation. I mean, just from the physics of it, in a way, women astronauts are preferable because you get all that same brain power in a much smaller and lighter package, and it's easier, cheaper to fly. So there's a lot of ways of looking at it. But they got a lot of challenges. You know, they got to come up with some extra money. So the budget's about $20-21 billion now for NASA every year.
Mm.
They're going to ask, as a down payment, as Bridenstine put it, they're looking for about $1.6 billion extra, which is nothing. We all expect that to go up as they move along. But it's worth remembering the Space Launch System, which is NASA's big mega rocket, and the Orion capsule, they've already spent about $30 billion building those things since the 2006 time frame, roughly. So, you know, they've got a great head start with all that stuff, but they got to really rush. One thing we don't have is moon suits. Because you think about it, they stopped building those in the 1960s, and the spacesuits that they use on the shuttle and the space station aren't quite the same thing. So that's something they're going to have to engineer pretty quick.
Is 2024 doable, do you think, Rod?
It's an interesting question. You get a lot of interesting answers. I was talking to an expert on my podcast the other day, and everybody kind of says the same thing. Well, yeah, given enough money and motivation, I think it is. It'll be in a pretty rudimentary form. They're going to have to scale back the Lunar Orbiting Gateway, which is this smaller version of the space station. They're going to put in orbit around the moon as a point of arrival and departure, potentially. And they're going to have to probably not just use the SLS, because it's very expensive to build and fly. It was interesting. Pence at one point said, if our current contractors can't meet this objective, we'll find one that will.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty chilling. You never heard that before.
No,
not quite those ways, and certainly not for the vice president.
Yeah.
So, you know, we think that there's a good chance that SpaceX and ultimately Blue Origin will have their shot. SpaceX has got a nice, inexpensive, comparatively speaking, heavy lift rocket that can do a lot of the work, and probably will. And in about the same timing as the NASA announcement, Jeff Bezos, very stylishly dressed, stepped up on a stage in D.C. and pulled a big black curtain off of his huge lunar lander mock-up. So he's been working on this thing for about 3 years to deliver cargo and bring back cargo from the moon. But he did point out very smartly that with a little bit of larger fuel tanks, it could carry people. So if you're NASA, do you want to start from scratch on a lunar lander or buy it from Amazon?
Okay. And by the way, free delivery on that.
Exactly.
Yeah,
two-day delivery. Or 2 day delivery.
2 day delivery, yeah.
So, I mean, but this is another space age, but it's a completely different thing, because you're seeing not just private industry get involved in a different way, which kind of had to happen because of the dynamics of the money, but these billionaires who are saying, I'm going to build it anyway. I'll take your money. I'd like to have your money, NASA, but I'm going to build it anyway, and if you like it, you can buy it. I'm paraphrasing pretty loosely here.
Right.
But this is the stuff of the 1950s. This is Destination Moon and Robert Heinlein.
Yeah.
So I just think it's thrilling. So, yeah, 2024, maybe 2025. 26, but let's just do it.
Yeah, you know? It's already got a great name, so that's
yeah. Well, and that's the important thing, right?
Right, right. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
Thanks.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us. We're talking space. If you have a question, it's 312-981-7200.
It's lonely out in space on such a time.
Oh, yeah. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. And we're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. Coming up after the 2:30 news, we are going to talk with a couple of members from the Talking Heads tribute band, Start Making Sense. They're playing at Martyrs this weekend. And then yesterday marked the fourth anniversary of the release of Mad Max Fury Road, which is one of my favorite movies ever. So we're going to talk about the fantastic and fun post-apocalyptic genre and talk about some of the best post-apocalyptic movies. We also have some product placement stories that we're going to share. All that and more. Our phone number is 312-981-7200 for talk, text, and your Triple Play Thursday requests. Get those in, one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. Let's get back to our conversation with Rod Pyle, who is an author, a journalist, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, space expert, and let's get Rod back. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
So tell us, tell everybody about Heroes of the Space Age, which just was released a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. So thank God that's the last book of the year. I really enjoy writing them, but the marketing is a bit intense. So that came out on May 7th. And it's seven chapters, eight heroes. The hard part was I knew writing it wasn't going to be terribly difficult because there's autobiographies and oral histories and tons of stuff on these guys and women. It was both men and women this time. But trying to slim it down to eight people is really tough, right?
Yeah.
Because there's all these great, and I didn't want to do every, you know, I knew I had to do Armstrong and Aldrin, and I had to do John Glenn, and I had to do the Valentina Tereshkova, the Soviet Union, and Yuri Gagarin, and so forth. But I wanted to get some interesting people in there, like Margaret Hamilton. There's this woman who was the first software engineer at MIT in their instrumentation lab, who was responsible for a big chunk of the programming in the Apollo guidance computer, which, you know, had 2K of RAM and I think 36K of ROM, which is pretty small, and just took us all the way to the moon and back.
Wow.
And she was responsible for the interrupt coding that kept the lunar module going when they were having the computer freezes that was heading down to the surface in Apollo 11.
Yeah.
So some known, some less known. Seems to get good reviews so far. So, hey, fingers crossed, go buy 10 copies for your friends.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. It is it's terrific, and I know that your Apollo book sold out in 3 hours, and I'm I'm very thrilled that I have a copy of it because it is a gorgeous book, absolutely gorgeous.
Thanks. They really, that was Sterling Publishing, and they really went the extra mile. I mean, just the quality of the cover and the embossing and all the stuff inside, and you know, they were generous with their budget, not just in terms of the book production, but in terms of acquiring stuff for it. So that was really a blessing to be able to work on that project. And having it actually sell well is really a thrill.
Yeah.
And I'm glad we got it out. We did, because I think last I counted, there were 22 Apollo books on the shelf. Three of them are mine because they reissued a couple of old ones that I did.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, man,
and there's,
the remainder bins are going to be full in a year.
Well, on top of that, there's new stuff coming out because, I mean, obviously we got the 50th anniversary coming up in July. And so, I mean, there are books and specials and all kinds of things happening. What are some of those things that you're looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing this Nat Geo film when it finally hits the theater because I've only seen working edits of it. I've got a stack of books that I still need to go through to review because the magazine, I get review copies of stuff. So John Lottis and Roger Lanius, who are both longtime experts and historians and policy guys in the field, have both written a couple each that hit the market this year. And, you know, every network's going to have a special of some kind and tons of independent stuff coming out. I kind of feel on the movie side, you know, between what I've seen Nat Geo doing and the Apollo 11 doc that just came out. I kind of feel like I might have seen the best already. I don't know. It's going to be interesting to see. At the conference you were talking about earlier, we're going to have a film festival for four of those nights.
Oh, great.
So we're bringing some of those along, and we're going to premiere the Nat Geo thing there. But, yeah, it's going to be quite a show. I guess the only part that makes me sad is I suspect, you know, there'll be the Apollo 11 50th, which is in July, and then there's going to be the Apollo 13 anniversary shortly after that. And the last handful of missions, the last four missions that inspiration and I think 10 people say, yeah, I've got Apollo fatigue, I'm over this.
Yeah.
And drift away. And it's a shame because those were really when it got interesting, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's going to be a busy summer for space fans. You must feel really gratified and happy that there's so much interest in this. Some 50 years later, that's got to be gratifying, right?
It's very gratifying. It's really gratifying when A, people buy your book, and B, you get calls to go talk places to people that wouldn't have thought about you the year before. So
yeah,
it's been kind of a bonanza that way. But I also know all these things have termination dates on them, so
right.
I'm trying to reap while the sun shines, you know, and then I'll just be grateful to continue coming on your show.
Well, we always appreciate it, and we'll do it again next month. Rod, always a pleasure. And,
awesome.
And there's going to be more to talk about in terms of Apollo as we get closer to the anniversary. So, and everybody, get a copy of Heroes of the Space Age. Check out rodpilebooks.com for all the information. And Rod, always a pleasure, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Nick, thank you. Take care.
All right, buddy. Rod Pyle, always great. You can check out rodpilebooks.com. His latest is called Heroes of the Space Age. And it is a terrific, terrific book, as are everything that he's written that I've read. So we're going to take a break. We got the news coming up right after this. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. And we are going to be talking about product placement and post-apocalyptic movies in honor of the anniversary of yesterday was the fourth anniversary of the release of Mad Max Fury Road. And we're going to get into that as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. And you can, of course, follow us on Twitter at Nick D Show and Facebook at Facebook.com/Nick D Show. That, what you just heard, obviously, was Talking Heads. And we're going to have on their show right now, there's a cover band called Start Making Sense that have been around for a while. And they're playing Friday and Saturday at Martyrs. It's $20 in advance, $25 at the door. The doors open at 9 o'clock, and they're going to do a full show. Start Making Sense. Two of the members of the band are here to talk about music and to talk about the Talking Heads and talk about their band. It's John Braun, who does lead vocals and plays guitar, and Jesse Braun, who's his brother and he plays drums. John, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it.
And Jesse, welcome to the show.
Thanks, man.
All right, let's talk a little about your background, John. Who's the older or the younger in the brothers here?
I guess I would be the older. That would be the case.
Okay, so John, you're the older brother
by 10 years, believe it or not.
Wow. Okay, great. And when did you get into music personally? And then I'll ask Jesse that question. When did you start getting into music, John?
His answer might mirror mine.
Okay.
Our father was a musician, so he was a drummer. He is a drummer, still currently.
Mm-hmm.
So from probably before I can recall.
So you always knew you wanted to be a musician?
Well, it didn't seem like a prosperous lifespan, but yes.
Okay. All right. Jesse, what about you? Same thing. Your dad is obviously the same dad, and he's a drummer. So tell me about your getting into music.
Yeah, it was the same thing, like right from the beginning. Like John said, before I can remember, I know I was, you know, hitting drums all the time.
Yeah. Now, John, did you not gravitate to the drums?
I did, actually. I'm a drummer first and foremost, and this happened later in life, and I had a little guitar experience.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone said, hey, you sound like David Byrne, you know,
yeah.
So maybe you should sing.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so but you must have grown up in a, you got a father who's a drummer. You guys have grown up in a loud house.
My statement is my mother is a saint that has yet to be recognized.
There were a lot of multiple drum sets.
Yeah, I would imagine. I can imagine. Are you guys just the only siblings, or do you have any other brothers and sisters?
Just the two of us.
No, it's
so okay, but still, both drumming like the dad. Yeah, your mom must be a saint. That's all there is to it. Got to be.
Yeah, it was a good 25-30 years of drums constantly.
Oh man, that's unbelievable. Now, where are you guys from, John? Where are you guys from?
We currently all reside in the Bethlehem, Pennsylvania area, which is right over the border from New Jersey into Pennsylvania. But a good chunk of the band was born and raised in New Jersey in the tri-state metro area.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. And how long have you been? How long has Start Making Sense been together?
We are in our 10th year as a band.
And you tour around the country doing this?
We do. We absolutely do. We're weekend warriors for the most part. We certainly play more than that, but for the most part, it's Thursday, Friday, Saturday, every week, 10 months out of the year.
Wow, that's boy, that's a lot of traveling. Jesse, you enjoy being on the road?
Yeah, man, it's great.
Well, where are some
of we get to go to a lot of places.
Yeah, where have you been? Tell me, Jesse, about some of the places you guys have played.
We do a lot of up and down the East Coast, you know, from Maine to Florida. And I guess maybe like the last 5 years or so, we've been heading out west further and further. So we've been doing Chicago for a while. We do, you know, Denver, Fort Collins area. And just a few months ago, we debuted on the West Coast in Seattle and Portland.
You guys get big crowds when you go to New York, I would imagine.
New York and Philly are two of the bigger cities for us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're from New York, so that's why I figured there would be a lot.
Yes.
But that's great. Now, you guys, outside of Start Making Sense, what other music guys are you involved in? John?
Jesse and I are both in an original band called Ruby Deer. Mm-hmm. With one of the backup singers from Start Making Sense, Jenny Founds. She plays guitar and sings, so the three of us have a trio doing all original music called Ruby Deer.
Oh, that's great, man. That's really cool. And have you recorded stuff?
We do. We have a full-length album out, and we're playing whenever we're not doing this. And actually, we open for ourselves sometimes.
Oh, do you?
Yep. Absolutely.
So that's Ruby Deer. Is there a website where people can check out the music?
Yeah, rubydeermusic.com. And all the streaming services have everything as well.
Do you enjoy obviously you're having fun doing the Talking Heads thing, but you got to really love doing your own stuff, right, John?
Well, it's a balance between the two, you know. One of the kind of unspoken, or actually spoken, things we have is if we're not having fun doing Start Making Sense, we'll stop.
Yeah,
you know, we're not gonna do this just to do it.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of tribute bands out there, and we've. Feel as though it's important that you enjoy what you do. So if that point ever comes, we will stop doing it.
What about the songwriting process for Ruby Deer? Tell me about that. Do you guys write the songs all together?
Jesse, you want to take that?
Yeah, sure. I would say the core or the bulk of the song comes from Jenny, and then the three of us kind of sit down and work it out. She writes kind of, you know, on piano or on a guitar, comes up with the chords and the melody, and then we kind of arrange it with the three of us.
Mm-hmm. And you guys play out pretty regularly then. And so it must be fun to open for yourselves.
It really is. It's interesting because we're throwing some. It's a little harder edged music.
Yeah.
Than Talking Heads. So it's interesting to throw it out and see what people respond to in that setting.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Have you guys ever played Martyrs here in Chicago before?
We absolutely have. I was in an original band for a very long time that toured the country relentlessly. And going on 15, 18 years of playing Martyrs.
It's a great room. It's one of the best rooms in the city.
It's one of the best rooms in the country, I would argue.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't traveled around a lot to a lot of venues, but all I know is that here in this city, Martyrs is right near the top of places to see shows.
Absolutely. Every person that works there, every person that has worked there, all of them top to bottom are wonderful people. And it's truly just a room for music.
Yeah.
First and foremost.
Absolutely. John, what was the band that you were in that you toured all over the place with?
Insidious Rays was the name of the band.
Okay. And you guys go ahead.
Independent rock and roll, punk rock, funk, psychedelic country band that toured for about 10 years.
Oh, that kind of thing. Sure, I know that sound. I'm familiar with that sound.
Of course. Yeah. Of course. Who isn't?
Yeah, that old cliche. Yeah, right there.
It fits right in at Martyrs.
Right. Jesse, how long you been playing out and stuff?
Wow, probably 15 years or so. Mm-hmm. I started gigging like most of us in local punk rock bands and stuff, and then I guess I was about 20 when we start making sense. So
Okay, all right, guys, hang on. Okay, I want to talk more about that. I want to talk about the Talking Heads and about your show that's coming up. You got two shows Friday and Saturday at Martyrs this weekend, guys. Hang on, okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, there's John Braun, who is the lead singer and plays guitar for Start Making Sense, and his brother Jesse Braun, who plays drums. And we're going to come back and talk more about Talking Heads. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We are live in the Allstate Skyline studio, and we are here until 5 a.m. It is Thursday, AAA Thursday. Get your request in now. One artist, three songs, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. We're going to talk about post-apocalyptic movies in honor of the fourth anniversary of the release of one of the greatest movies ever made, Mad Max Fury Road. We're also going to talk about product placement. And most famous uses of product placement. And there's a lot of them. So we'll get into that as well. Our phone number is 312-981-7200. You heard Talking Heads there coming out of the break. That's because we're talking two members of a Talking Heads tribute band called Start Making Sense. They're playing two nights at Martyrs on Lincoln Avenue here in Chicago. They're playing Friday the 17th and Saturday the 18th. And we've got John Braun and Jesse Braun, who are two members of the band. John, Jesse, welcome back, gentlemen.
Thank you, Nick.
Thanks for having
us. I would
love
to talk about Mad Max and product placement whenever, if we have the time. That sounds amazing.
Yeah. It was the fourth anniversary of Fury Road, which is a movie that the weekend it opened, I saw it three times in 2 days.
I still haven't seen it yet, but it is on my list to sit down to watch thoroughly.
Yeah, I believe your head will explode. That's what happened to me.
I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. So, well, welcome back, you guys. Let's talk about your first experience. We'll start with you guys. We'll start with you, John. What your first experience with Talking Heads? Can you remember the first time that you heard or saw them?
Certainly saw. I'm 39 years old, so I was very very conscious in the late 80s, so that was all over MTV.
Yeah.
So the Burning Down the House video and the Once in a Lifetime video are etched upon my brain.
Yeah. And yeah, so that's how. What about you, Jesse? Same thing?
No, not so much.
10 years younger.
Oh, that's right. You're 10 years younger.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. So I was always, I was aware of the hits and stuff. And I guess probably in high school at some point, I realized that all these songs I knew were the same band,
mm-hmm.
and kind of started digging in based on that. But I don't think there's one specific point that I remember hearing it for the first time.
Yeah. Yeah. I was, I'm older than you guys. And I got turned on to them pretty early on. And by the time Stop Making Sense came out, and I saw it at the Fine Arts Theater down on Michigan Avenue here in Chicago, I went pretty much every weekend when Stop Making Sense was playing at the theater. I think it's the best concert movie ever made. And I love the band. I love David Byrne. I also love the fact that David Byrne inducted Radiohead into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. That seemed really apropos.
I saw that. Someone was
listening
really cool.
to the lyrics.
It was really great. Yeah, exactly. They took the name from one of the songs. Exactly, from one of the lyrics.
That was a great introduction.
Yeah.
His points about their business moves in the music industry was really characteristic for David Byrne to shift to somewhere you wouldn't expect.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Really, really interesting.
Absolutely. It was really fun to see. So how did it Start Making Sense get started?
Much like This Must Be the Band, which was the Chicago premier Talking Heads tribute band for a very long time.
Yeah.
Our local venue, which here our Martyrs equivalent would be the Fun House, which is a bar in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. And the owner there just asked us to do a night of music tributing one band, and we had kind of a conglomerate of local musicians. And we weren't really sure what to do. And she said, why don't you do Talking Heads? So we did. And, 150, 200 people showed up. And then the following weeks and months, more people started asking us to do it.
Oh, that's great.
And here we are 10 years later.
Jesse, how many people in the band?
Currently there's seven. I think when we started there were nine. And we've kind of shifted in instrumentation. I think we started with three guitarists, so it's changed a bit over the years, but most of the original members are still there.
Now, do you guys try to recreate the shows perfectly? Do you wear the big suit?
If the venue is appropriate where I can run off stage and change into it, yes.
Right.
but not every night. We've done the Stop Making Sense film recreation live two times, and we're going to be doing it later in this year and next year.
Oh, that's cool.
But for the most part, it's kind of a homogenized version of it. So we're pulling in the visual elements that people expect to see, and then the rest of it is kind of whatever happens that night.
That's cool. Well, how do the crowds react to your shows? Jesse?
I was going to pass that off.
That's fine. It's kind of like a big dance party.
Yeah.
It's really fun, upbeat, danceable music. So it appears as though everyone's having a good time.
It appears as though everybody's having a good time. That is fantastic. That's great. So it's two shows, and it's Friday, May 17th, Saturday, May 18th at Martyrs on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago. And you guys can check out Start Making Sense. It sounds like a blast. John, do you have a favorite Talking Heads song?
No, it shifts constantly. A lot of times it lands on being The Great Curve.
Okay.
For some reason.
Uh-huh.
I'm not 100% sure why. But that ends up being my favorite a fair amount of the time.
Okay. Jesse, what about you? You have a favorite Talking Heads song?
Like John, it kind of changes over time. But I think the one I always come back to, funny enough, isn't really a Talking Heads song.
Mm-hmm.
But it is in the film, Stumming Sense. What a Day That Was.
Oh,
it's actually a David Byrne song.
Yeah.
But they played it on that tour, and it's in the film. And I don't know. There's something about that bass line that is just super funky.
Yeah. What do you think it is? What do you think about why the band Talking Heads have such lasting appeal? Because people still love them, and they haven't really been together since the early '90s.
Yeah, I think they're just super unique. You know, there's nothing no other bands that really sound like them. And yet they have, they kind of touch on a variety of genres, and they, you know, Psycho Killer sounds nothing like The Great Curve, you know?
Yeah.
But somehow there's this through line in all of their music. So they're super unique. And I think, you know, people, new people keep discovering it. So, and the music never really gets stale for anybody. So,
yeah. Do you guys ever bust out any of the acts that are like, do you ever do any Tom Tom Club?
We do. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jesse can answer that one.
I get to sing the, Genius of Love.
Oh, do you really? You guys do that? Actually. That's awesome. That's awesome. That's great. You
James
do...
Brown.
Yeah,
James Brown.
There you go. There it is, man. Did you get? Do you guys do any Casual Gods or Modern Lovers or anything like that?
We haven't yet.
Yeah.
Yet. That's funny. Jesse said the exact same thing I did. We've dove into the David Byrne solo catalog a little bit.
Yeah.
Live.
Yeah.
And I think the next step would be to dig into the Jerry Harrison stuff and kind of dig a little deeper. So absolutely, that would be that. You just gave us a great idea.
I get credit for that. Okay, when you guys do that, you got to give me credit.
We'll debut it in Chicago.
All right, there you go. You know, I always ask musicians the same. Whenever I have musicians on very frequently. I always ask them two questions. So, John, I'll start with you.
Okay.
What was the first album you ever bought?
Oh, with my own money.
Yeah.
Ooh. The Who's Next.
Oh, good one.
Yeah, I got lucky.
Jesse, what about you? Jesse, what about you? First album you ever bought?
I have trouble. I don't remember too clearly, but I want to say it was the Dead Kennedys Fresh Fruit for Rotting Vegetables.
Okay.
Like the first thing I went out and bought with my own money.
There you go, man. Okay, good. All right, John, first concert you ever saw?
Oh, it was the Rascals and Tommy James with my parents Giant Stadium.
You know what's insane
86.
Is that we were just talking about when I was a kid, I loved Tommy James and the Shondells. One of the first bands I ever gravitated to when I was a little kid, because I'm going to be 54 in July. So like I was right around the time I was about 5 or 6 when Crimson and Clover was out and all that stuff. And I just
absolutely
jumped head first into Tommy James and the Shondells. They're so
That's
great.
So funny.
Yeah. All right. Jesse, first concert you ever saw, Jesse. I'm assuming it's going to be a punk. I'm assuming it's going to be a punk show.
I definitely grew up going to shows and festivals, but there was one, probably the first time I went, like, without my parents, was some friends of mine and I bought John a ticket to take us to see the Circle Jerks, because we were too young to go out by ourselves, and none of our parents wanted to go. So,
oh, really? Your parents?
We gave him gas money and a ticket, and he brought us.
Yeah, that's a fantastic story. Seriously, your parents didn't want to see a band called the Circle Jerks? They didn't?
Believe it or not.
So you guys are pretty much, you guys have families and stuff, and do they travel with you?
Oh no, we're pretty much lone wolves out there.
Okay.
Yeah. One of our members has a wife and a son,
mm-hmm.
but he still travels as regularly as he can.
Yeah.
And the rest of us are obviously in relationships, and we hold our home life down because we're doing the Weekend Warrior thing.
Sure.
Kind of like traveling salesman kind of.
Yeah. Well.
But we're doing all right.
Good, man. That's really good. You know, it was great talking to you guys, man. And I hope you. I'm glad you like Chicago so much, and I'm glad you like Martyrs. We're real happy about that place here in the city.
So are we. Thank you.
Okay, so that's Start Making Sense. If you love Talking Heads and you want to see a great Talking Heads tribute band, check out these guys. They're playing Friday and Saturday night this weekend at Martyrs, 3855 North Lincoln Avenue, $20 in advance, $25 at the door. The doors open at 9 o'clock. Martyrs is a great room. It's going to be a great show. John, Jesse, thank you guys. So much fun talking to you.
Thanks, Nick.
Thank you, Nick. Appreciate it.
Take care, buddy. There you go. John and Jesse Braun from Start Making Sense. A great Talking Heads tribute band. You can check them out again at Martyrs this Friday and Saturday. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We got the news coming up next right here on 720 WGN.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings. wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arrive.
Right. Well, that's a really good way to kick off Triple Play Thursday. That's about the best way that you can kick off Triple Play Thursday. Triple Play Thursday, you made Triple Play Thursday. It's one artist, three songs. Obviously, that's the Beatles. Who requested the Beatles?
That was Elaine.
Elaine. Okay. So there you go. Beautiful song, too, Blackbird.
Absolutely.
All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell following this show at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. 312-981-7200 is the phone number if you want to join us. A little bit later on, we're going to be talking about most famous product placement in entertainment. But right now, we want you to call in and text in your favorite dystopian slash post-apocalyptic movies. What are the best ones? 312-981-7200 for talk and text. 312-981-7200. Yesterday marked the fourth anniversary of the release of Mad Max Fury Road, which people who are regular listeners or follow me on Facebook know that I've seen it. I don't even know how many times I've seen it. I stopped count at maybe 100 times. I just, every once in a while, I just go, yeah, I'll put it in the player and watch it. I know every line from the movie. I know every moment, and I never tire of it. As I've said before, on the day it was released, I saw it three times in less than 24 hours in the theater. And I saw it in the theater. I can't tell you how many times I saw it in the theater, a bunch of times in the theater. They re-released it in September of 2015 for just a weekend in IMAX and 3D. And I went all 3 days. I went Friday, Saturday, and Sunday in IMAX 3D. I think it's an incredible film. One of the most cinematically perfect films ever made. I think George Miller is one of the best filmmakers on the planet. He's only directed one movie that I don't like, and that's The Witches of Eastwick. And it was gratifying to know that he also doesn't like that movie. When Robert Rodriguez interviewed him on El Rey, the one-on-one interview, he said that he didn't enjoy working on that movie at all. There were too many stars, too many chefs making the soup, and he didn't get final cut on it, and just did not enjoy it. And it's the only movie of his that I don't like. He made and he's made all kinds of movies, Tom, have you ever seen Lorenzo's Oil?
Yeah.
Beautiful movie.
And great reference in the movie Paul.
Yes.
If you remember Lorenzo's Oil.
Yeah. Yeah. Which Paul, by the way, is an underrated movie.
Yeah.
It's a very, very funny movie.
Very much.
I think people underrate it because Edgar Wright didn't direct it. But it was directed by
Greg Mottola,
who directed one of my favorite movies of all time, Adventureland, which is one of my favorite films of all time, with one of the greatest soundtracks ever. When the opening credits, first of all, Yo La Tengo did the soundtrack for Adventureland, did the score, and the soundtrack has some of the greatest songs ever. It takes place in the 80s. Late 80s, 88, I think, is when it takes place, 88 or 89. And I was, one of the other reasons why I loved Adventureland so much is because I was the age of the main characters in that movie at that time. So I was like Jesse Eisenberg's age in like 88 when they made that movie. And I adore that movie. I absolutely love it. And any movie that opens with Bastards of Young by The Replacements, I was like, okay. So, I love that movie. So, Mottola. But anyway, Lorenzo's Oil, a great drama, really wonderful movie with great performances. It was a medical drama about a couple played by Nick Nolte and Susan Sarandon who were trying to find a cure for the illness that their child had. This does not sound like a George Miller movie, you know, but it's brilliant. It's great.
Now, did he do both Babe and Babe 2?
He did the second. He did Babe in the City.
Pig in the City.
Yeah, which is a much darker, crazier movie than the first one. And the first one's great.
Yeah.
He produced the first one. But he directed Babe, Pig in the City, which is an absolutely insane movie. And really dark.
For kids? Yeah.
Oh, my God.
It's weird.
But it's great. And he did both Happy Feet movies, and those are great. And then he went back to his beloved Mad Max world and made Fury Road, and it was released 4 years ago yesterday. And I think it's a perfect movie, and it won the most Academy Awards that year. I remember watching it, and at one point it won like four in a row, and at one point I was like, you know what, maybe George Miller's going to win Best Director. I was just so, because he kept winning. It won six Oscars. It won the most of any of the Academy Award nominees that year. The movie that won that year was Spotlight, which is a really terrific movie.
It is.
It's a really terrific. It's not Fury Road, but no. It's really terrific. Mm-hmm. And then Inarritu won Direction for was it Revenant?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because he had won, because he won director the previous year.
Yeah, he won for Birdman.
That Birdman also won Best Picture.
Yeah, and it's like five of the last six directors, and I love this, five of the last six directors who won Best Director, Mexican.
Yeah.
I love that. Yeah. Because Cuarón won, and Del Toro won.
Del Toro, finally.
And of course, Inarritu.
And the thing that blew my mind about it is that they are all buddies.
Oh, yeah. They call themselves the Three Amigos.
Yeah.
I love those guys, and they're great in different ways. You know what I mean? I think all three are great filmmakers. Really great. I think Immortos Perros is one. Oh, my God, is that a good movie. And I love Birdman. I know a lot of people were down on Birdman, but I loved it.
I'm big into Birdman.
Yeah, it's a great movie. And Inarritu loves the long takes, and so does Cuarón. You know, the opening scene in Gravity is 13 minutes long. God bless him.
But like, if you're Alfonso Cuarón and you basically just annihilate the game with Children of Men, that last long take.
Well,
of course you love long takes. It's amazing.
The Children of Men, absolutely one of my favorite movies ever.
Great post-apocalyptic movie.
Absolutely, and it totally fits in with this one, with this topic that we're talking about. It is an incredibly great post-apocalyptic movie. It also is kind of frightening in how effective it is with what we're going through right now.
It feels very real.
Oh my God.
It feels very, very real.
Absolutely. But that one take, there's a bunch of long takes in it, but the take where she has the baby, and then afterwards they're trying to get the baby out of the war zone, and it's one long take where they're running down in the middle of a war zone. There are bullets flying all over the place, explosions everywhere, soldiers, people fighting, and he has to run and to get through this battle zone, and they get into a building, and it's all one take, and it's like a seven and a half minute take. And at one point, because Cuarón is running next to the cameraman, beside the cameraman during the whole thing, when the cameraman is running. And at one point, they get on a bus, and they get on a bus which is, like, stalled. And they get on a bus to get away from some of the bullets, and they're running through the bus. And at one point, someone gets shot in front of the camera lens, and blood splashes on the lens of the camera. So Cuarón yelled, cut, and nobody heard him. He yelled, cut, and nobody heard him because of all the noise. So they kept going. So at one point, they get next to the building, and there's a blood splot. You know, there's a blood splot on the lens of the camera. For, I don't know, minute or so, 35, 45 seconds a minute. So they get off the bus, they run next to the building, and then they cower down behind a rock to stay away from the bullets that are flying. And at that point, Cuarón took his shirt and wiped the lens and got the blood off. So so he pulled the camera down, kept the take going, wiped the blood off, and put the camera back up.
He's a renegade.
Yeah, he's a great filmmaker. He's a great, great filmmaker.
Made the best Harry Potter movie.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. Not my favorite book, but it's my favorite movie.
Mm-hmm.
Of the my favorite book is Half-Blood Prince is my favorite of the books. But yeah, Azkaban is, and it's so completely different than the book. That's why a lot of people were so mad about it, because he took a lot of liberties with the book, changed a lot of it. So that's why most Harry Potter fans that's their least favorite. That's my most favorite. Because I love Cuarón. I think he's just an unbelievable filmmaker.
Yeah.
I mean, unbelievable. And that man, oh man, Roma. Come on now! Best movie of last year. Good God, he's a good filmmaker. But yeah, since we're on that post-apocalyptic topic, Children of Men, one of the way up there. Clive Owen, so good in it. Julianne Moore, amazing.
Michael Caine as a hippie.
Michael Caine is so good. He's so good in it. Yeah, I adore that movie, and it still holds up. And when it first came, I came out 2006. There wasn't a better movie that came out that year. I was stunned by it, absolutely stunned. And it's a great post-apocalyptic movie. And it's kind of scary because it's kind of coming true. How about, here's another one, kind of a post-apocalyptic. Idiocracy, which is also shockingly accurate. Idiocracy is now a documentary. It used to be a far-fetched science fiction post-apocalyptic comedy, and now it's a documentary. That's what's happened since that movie came out. And it is a brilliant movie and really, really funny.
Yeah, the what was the wrestler turned president? Dwayne Elizondo Mountain Dew Herbert Camacho.
Yeah, I remember it's Camacho. I forgot the whole thing before that.
I just love the Mountain Dew in the middle of it.
Terry Crews, brilliant.
Such a funny guy.
Stephen Root, hilarious in Idiocracies. And perfect casting. Luke Wilson is the perfect person to play that role.
He's an everyman. You know?
He is, and he's not real. And he seems not real bright. And then he turns out to be the most brilliant guy in the world. And Dax Shepard, hilarious. Maya Rudolph. That movie is brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. A great post-apocalyptic movie. Before we break, here's Ike on WGN. Go ahead, Ike.
Hey, Nick. How's it going with you, man? Okay, this is definitely a classic post-apocalyptic. This is by my favorite filmmaker, of course, yours, John Carpenter, Escape from New York.
Yeah, Escape from New York. Way, way, way up high on the list of post-apocalyptic movies, and I back Escape from L.A.
Yeah, I'm with you with that. When I first saw those two movies back in '96 when L.A. was coming out, I saw the first one on tape. I was just so blown away.
Yeah.
Got me more movies than ever.
That's
definitely.
Great. All right, Ike, thanks.
No problem.
Speaking of Carpenter just won the Golden
Coach
Award at Cannes Film Festival. They honored him at the Cannes Film Festival. Never been honored in America.
No. They don't. But we don't realize what we have on our hands here.
Escape from New York, which, by the way, is on this. I have a list here from Screen Rant. And of course, Escape from New York's on the list. It has to be. Has to be. So we could also say maybe the last 15, 20 minutes of In the Mouth of Madness.
Oh, yeah. There's nothing better than when he goes into the movie theater
is
watching the movie
and
itself.
Laughing.
And just freaking. Yeah. Sam Neill, what a treasure.
A great performance, man. That is a great, great performance. So what do you guys think? Dystopian post-apocalyptic movies in honor of the fourth anniversary of the release of The Ultimate Fury Road. 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
Have you seen the little piggies crawling in the dark? Always having dirt to play around in.
Is every show this week at some point going to reference Charles Manson? Is that what's going on?
Yeah, you know, there's something in the water, man.
God.
Believe it or not, you know, it's too bad that Helter Skelter was not one of the ones requested.
Well, Piggies is Piggies. Oh, man.
Good for you, Elaine.
Oh, boy. All right. That's a great song, though.
Great song.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Triple Play Thursday. That's one artist, three songs. 312-981-7200. That's also the number to call or text. We are talking about post-apocalyptic movies, dystopian future movies. Which ones do you like? Which ones are your favorites? And that's in honor of the fourth anniversary of the release of Mad Max Fury Road. So we've talked about a few great ones here. And 301 area code says, good morning, Tom. Here are my favorite post-apocalyptic movies. All of the Mad Max films. A Boy and His Dog, which we will talk about a little bit later on. Have you seen A Boy and His Dog?
Yes. Oh, we actually just got a call from Steven Galesburg saying, you know, have I seen it?
A Boy and His Dog. Great. The Omega Man, which is Charlton Heston. And then I Am Legend, which is the same. Based on the same story.
Yep.
And then that was also there was a third one, Last Man on Earth, with Vincent Price. So that story is Matheson, right? Matt Matheson.
Yeah, that's Richard Matheson.
And so there's three versions of that. Nobody likes any of them.
I think the Omega Man's all right.
Omega Man's fun because it's Heston.
It's Heston
being Heston.
I think that's why.
And I love Vincent Price. I actually like the Will Smith version. It's one of the only Will Smith movies I like, but I hate the ending.
I remember getting really scared
in the theater when the trailer came out, because it felt very, the first part of that movie with all the jets and everything,
yeah,
feels very real. I'm like, oh wow, this feels very post 9/11.
Except they really blew the ending. I mean, like, they completely blew the ending.
Yeah, did not stick it.
28 Days Later is on the 301 list.
Sincerely terrifying. Yeah. Every time.
Yep. I like 28 Weeks Later too. I thought they were both good. 28 Days Later though was kind of a game changer. I remember when it came out, you know, there was kind of nothing like it at that point. But it did open up the doors for fast zombies, even though they're not zombies in 28 Days Later. But then, you know, suddenly it was like, oh, let's do fast zombies. No. No.
Come on.
You know, when George Romero came to flashback one of the many years that he did, he had, of course, he had a merch table set up, and his agent was working the merch table, and he was signing autographs, pictures, and all that stuff, as you do at a convention. And one of the items that that he was selling was on his merch table was a T-shirt, which I bought. No, actually, sorry, they gave it to me. I can rub everybody's nose in it. Got it for free.
Thanks, man.
Directly from George Romero.
Talk about your beautiful relationship with him as well.
So, and it just said on the front, it just says, "Fast zombies suck," and on the back it says, "Slow zombies rule." So immediately I said, "I need that shirt."
Ah, man. You know, I know it's an eternal debate, and it's always going to be up to taste. And of course, I love the slow zombies. My favorite zombie movie is Day of the Dead. Love it. Love it. I see the argument. I see the argument for the fast.
Yeah.
Because that that Zack Snyder Dawn of the
it's
Dead.
It's good.
It's good.
It's real good.
It's different. That's all I like to say to people. It's like, hey, man, call them infected. Call them whatever you like. It's different. It's of a different time. They wanted to change up the formula.
I really surprisingly liked the remake of Dawn of the Dead. So, because I went in with the, because Dawn of the Dead is one of my favorite movies ever made and the best zombie movie ever made. And How Dare You is what I was saying. And How Dare You Make the Zombies Fast. But I got to say, it's nowhere near as good as the original.
No, but it's Zack Snyder's.
But it's great. It's And it's also the best thing he's ever directed. Without.
Not here for Batman versus Superman.
Oh, God. I liked Watchmen. I thought Watchmen.
I do like Watchmen.
Yeah. 262 area code says, War of the Worlds feels so real. I tried to catch it on TV. That's from Jay. I'll tell you what. The Spielberg version is scary as hell.
It's not bad.
No, it's good. It's really good. And it's, I thought Spielberg's War of the Worlds was really scary. I mean, like.
Yeah. I would agree.
And also, you know, an allegory for 9/11. I thought Spielberg did a great job. I think that the two movies that Spielberg made with Tom Cruise are two of his best movies. Because that and Minority Report. I mean, Minority Report is unbelievable.
I kind of wish that Spielberg did, obviously he did quite a bit of sci-fi. I don't count E.T. Not a big fan of E.T. But,
yeah, well, I mean, he did a lot of sci-fi.
Yeah.
You know?
Close Encounters.
Close Encounters. If you want to count Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull, because it becomes a science fiction movie.
Of course.
Minority Report, AI. I hated AI.
Everybody hates AI.
No. It's got a big following.
Of course it does.
It's got a big following. And I'll tell you what. What's funny is that, you know, that's obviously the last project that Kubrick was working on before he passed away, and that's why Spielberg picked up on it. But I'll tell you something. Minority Report is more Kubrickian by far than AI. By far. And that felt like more of a Kubrick movie, Minority Report, than AI did. So, all right, and AI is a post-apocalyptic film as well. All right, we'll taking a break here, and in honor of the fourth anniversary of one of the greatest movies ever made, Fury Road, we're talking about dystopian future and post-apocalyptic movies. 312-981-7200 for talk and text.
Now, somewhere in the black mining hills of Dakota, there lived a young boy named Rocky Raccoon. One day his woman ran off with another guy, hit young Rocky in the eye. Rocky didn't like that. He said, I'm gonna get that boy.
This is Elaine?
Yeah.
She likes the White Album.
Hey, I like the White Album.
Yeah.
That was the first Beatles album I ever heard and ever bought. It was the White Album.
Wow.
I picked a doozy.
Yeah, you did. And you picked the album that clearly showed how splintered they were.
Yeah.
Because there's your George songs, there's your Ringo song, there's your Paul song. I mean, it was just, you know. It's a great record, though.
I thought my face was going to melt listening to Revolution Number 9.
Oh, God. Well, didn't you get...
Oh, God.
You got hazed, right?
I got hella hazed.
got very hazed with Revolution Number 9 of all things.
It's what's insane is that, you know, our good friend Lindsey Cochran, who puts together Great Moments in Vinyl, they did the White Album, and they did Revolution Number 9 on stage.
That would be so cool, though, because it's such an interesting piece of music.
They did. They did it on stage. I was like, because, you know, when they were on to talk about it, and I was like, you're not doing Revolution Number 9, are you? And Lindsey's like, yes, we are. And I was like, wow, all right. and it turned out insane, as that's the song is insane. So it's Triple Play Thursday, by the way. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. And it's one artist, three songs, 312-981-7200. We're talking about the great post-apocalyptic movies and dystopian future movies. 312-981-7200. A little intro here from the article that I've got in front of me. While dystopian movies deal with society gone wrong, post-apocalyptic movies take place in a world where society has ended. In one way, the concept is actually quite optimistic, as it presumes that no matter if how the world ends, people will keep surviving to keep mankind going. In recent years, zombies have been particularly popular instigators of the apocalypse. But there are plenty of other scary, satirical, sad, or silly depictions of our world after the end. So grab your Geiger counters and your sawed-off shotguns and get ready. So they put Omega Man on the list. This is from Scream Rant. And then that's there are 14 of them here. That's number 14. Number 13, they include Zardoz, which is one of the... If you've never seen that movie, it is the great John Borman directed. It's one of the craziest movies ever made. I mean, it's truly insane.
It's so good.
The gun is good, the penis is evil, the penis shoots seeds, so proclaims the giant levitating stone head at the beginning of Zardoz, one of the craziest sci-fi movies ever made, set in a post-apocalyptic world of 2293. Zardoz follows a barbarian named Zed, played by Sean Connery, dressed in latex underwear with a braided ponytail. Zed discovers a hidden society of immortal humans hiding from the remains of mankind, while immortal Consuela, played by Charlotte Rampling, urges Zed's destruction. Others want to examine this virile savage. This may prove their undoing. Made in 1974 as an Irish-American co-production, Zardoz was a passion project for the acclaimed filmmaker John Borman, known for such movies as Point Blank, Deliverance, Excalibur, and also Hope and Glory, which is one of my favorite movies ever. Zardoz is one of those rare movies that can be easily watched both as a cult sci-fi film and a so bad it's so good entertainment.
I really like Zardoz.
It's insane. I was a kid when I saw it, and I didn't know what the hell was going on.
Yeah.
Came out in 74, so I was 9.
Watching Sean Connery and I saw it run around in a thong.
I saw it in the theater, and I'm like, what is happening? A Boy and His Dog is obviously mentioned, as we talked about earlier, Don Johnson. On the Beach, based on the famous book, which is a really terrific movie. Time of the Wolf from 2003. Austrian filmmaker Michael Haneke, whose movies, for the most part, I like, actually. It's weird, because I like him and I don't like von Trier. Mm-hmm. And they're both similar in the fact that they tortured the audience.
Yeah.
But I like his movies. I like Haneke's movies.
Funny Games.
Love Funny Games.
Funny Games.
I love both versions of it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. I can't remember. What the hell is the name of it? Oh, man. Oh, God. I can't remember the name of it. Could you look him up? Because there was one that came out like in the mid-2000s. It's a one-word title.
Amour?
No.
Or no, Cachet?
That's it.
Yeah.
Man. As anyone who's watched Funny Games can attest, while most of the titles on this list are escapist fantasies, Time of the Wolf is an unflinching look at a cruel human drama in a rapidly collapsing society. It follows George and Anne and their children as they flee the city of an unspecified disaster. But countryside proves equally dangerous, with villagers looking only for themselves and robbers taking all of their possessions. So, I'm just thrilled that this is mentioned. I'm totally thrilled that this is mentioned. Doomsday. I love this movie. Unapologetically love this movie. In the near future, entire Scotland is walled off into a giant quarantine zone. Does that sound familiar? Something like a city is walled off or a place is walled off?
Yeah.
That sounds familiar. It also,
I mean, that's something that literally historically happened.
Yeah.
Hadrian's Wall.
Yeah. After a deadly plague ravaged its population, 30 years later, a new outbreak of the pandemic is in England. The only hope for a cure may lie in the survivors inside the quarantine. Major Eden Sinclair, played by Rona Mitra, is sent there to find Dr. Marcus Kane, played by Malcolm McDowell. So work on a vaccine for this to be worked on a vaccine for the deadly disease. However, the ruins of Scotland are populated by cannibalistic marauders led by Saul Craig Conway. If you're going to steal, steal from the best is what they say. Neil Marshall's Doomsday is a fun mix of action and horror, but it isn't nearly as good as the classics that so obviously inspired it. Most of all, George Miller's Mad Max and John Carpenter's Escape from New York. Released in 2008, Doomsday received mixed reviews and was a commercial failure. Hey, I liked it. I liked it. Let's see. We got some texts coming in. Mark the Breadman says, my vote for best post-apocalyptic movies would be the George Romero Dead movies. Yes, I think we can all kind of agree on that one. Mike from Novak Construction here says, go with the movie A Boy and His Dog. Thanks. Everybody loves A Boy and His Dog. Do the Terminator movies count as post-apocalyptic movies? The second film is an effort to prevent the apocalypse from happening. That's Tim. Those Salvation is post-apocalyptic.
Yeah, that gets into the actual, which I think is a better movie than most people give it credit for.
Oh, God.
I like it. Oh, I think...
McG.
Okay. I understand. But I think Anton Yelchin is pretty good as Kyle Reese.
You know,
as a young Kyle Reese.
I love Anton Yelchin. I didn't like him in that. I didn't like him in that, but I love the guy. And he passed away way too soon. And by the way, one of his last performances, was Thoroughbreds. He's unbelievable in that movie.
That's a wild movie.
It's a great movie.
Yeah.
I love that movie. The two women in that movie, so good.
It's Anna Taylor-Johnson
and Olivia Cooke.
Olivia Cooke. Oof.
Children of Men, 630 area code says, 773 area code says, Omega Man and Planet of the Apes.
Yeah. Planet of the Apes.
Classic.
And honestly, I really like Beneath the Planet of the Apes a lot.
My favorite is of the original five, of the OG five Planet of the Apes movies, the best is the first one. I mean, it's a landmark piece of science fiction with, you know, I've got an article that I've saved we can talk about with perhaps the best surprise twist ending in the history of film.
Yeah.
But I love my second favorite of the original five is Conquest.
Conquest is cool.
Love Conquest. And
is that the last one of the five?
No, the last was Battle
of the Planet.
So it goes in order. It goes Planet of the Apes, Beneath, Escape, Conquest, Battle. Those are the five Planet of the Apes movies. And the reason I love Conquest, because it's like a reversal. It's like the apes are being enslaved instead of the humans.
Yeah.
And Caesar rises up and leads the uprising, which is essentially what happened in the remakes, in the reboots.
Uh-huh.
They basically took Conquest
and they went from there.
Yeah.
I like Beneath because, one, James Franciscus.
Well, yeah, they had to get somebody. They couldn't get Heston. Heston would only do a cameo. So they were like, let's get somebody who looks like Heston. Let's dress him up like Heston.
And I like James Francis.
I do too. James Franciscus is awesome. There are three guys that you can get confused because there's James Franciscus, there's James Ferrantino, and there's Tony Franciosa. And they were all popular at the same time. They were all popular like late 60s into the 70s. James Franciscus, James Ferrantino, and Tony Franciosa.
Well, and you've got the Beneath has the Cult of the Bomb.
Terrifying.
So freaky.
I remember the first time I saw that movie, because I was a little kid when those movies came out. Uh-huh. We saw that at the drive-in. I remember seeing Beneath at the drive-in. And when they take off the Victor Buono, when they take off those masks, I was like, oh, it scared the hell out of me. Scared the hell out of me. I like the fifth one. Escape is just a comedy.
Yeah,
it's essentially like
comedy.
It's a fish out of water. Oh, you know, comedy kind of. With a very dark ending. And then Conquest is just, you know, flat out fantastic. And then Battle, you know, as the movies went on, you know, 20th Century Fox was making a lot of money on those things, but they kept cutting the budgets.
Yeah, that was when they were really out of money.
And by the fifth one, the masks are just kind of rubber. They're not nearly as good, and the effects of the sets are bad.
Yeah.
I still have a, you know, it's a soft spot in my heart for all five of those Planet of the
Apes.
It's
worth a watch.
Oh, yeah, of course it is. Yeah. All five of them are. And they used to do Ape Week on the Channel 7 3:30 movie. That was after school. You would go rush home and watch the Channel 7 3:30 movie, and it would be Monday through Friday. So they would do Ape Week. The problem was that the 3:30 movie was only 90 minutes of time, so it would go from 3:30 to the 5 o'clock news. Planet of the Apes is like 2 hours and 10 minutes long, and so not only did they have to cut it down, but they had to cut it down to fit commercials in. So you would see in all the Planet of the Apes movies, when they would do Ape Week, you would see maybe 3/4 of each movie. They would cut the rest of them.
That's unfortunate.
but I watched it every time. Ape Week. All right. We'll get some weather here, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit more about post-apocalyptic movies. Which ones are the best? Right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich has the opening bell at 5, Steve Cochran at 6. And we're talking about post-apocalyptic movies. It's also Triple Play Thursday. You have your Triple Play Thursday? One artist, three songs. Who requested that?
That was coming from Sam.
Sam.
Little Allman Brothers.
That's right, Allman Brothers. All right. Hey, also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. So in honor of the 4th anniversary of the release of one of my favorite movies ever made in the history of anything, Mad Max Fury Road, we're talking about the best and most fun and coolest post-apocalyptic movies of all time. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Todd says everyone is missing The Matrix. That's true. Absolutely true. Yeah. And 847 area code says The Time Machine, Night of the Living Dead, Mad Max, and Zombieland. I'm so excited for the sequel. And I'm so glad they got everybody back.
Yeah, it's taken a long time.
And, you know, since that movie, you know, a couple of the people have become major players. Like Jesse Eisenberg, Emma Stone, you know, is now an Oscar winner.
Yeah. Even the director did the first Deadpool.
He did. He did and he also directed the, which I'm so sad is canceled, the Santa Clarita Diet on Netflix with Drew Barrymore and Timothy Oliphant. Speaking of Timothy Oliphant, we were only 2 weeks away from Deadwood.
Wait, really?
Yeah, man.
That's that fast.
May 31st. Yeah.
So I got Deadwood. I got Godzilla, King of the Monsters.
Let me explain something to you. They debut the same day. Deadwood is May 31st on HBO, the Deadwood movie that we've been waiting for 900 years. And Godzilla, King of the Monsters comes out on May 31st.
I don't even know what I'm going to do that weekend. Yeah. I mean, I'm going to...
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to watch Deadwood on Friday.
Of course.
And
save Godzilla for
Saturday. Well, I got my tickets already for Godzilla.
There you go.
They're in IMAX. My folks and I are going to go. You know who's really excited? My mom. My mom is unbelievably excited about the new Godzilla movie, which makes me so happy. Makes me so happy. My mom is beside herself with excitement. So, all right. All right, how about this one? Turbo Kid tells the feverish fantasy of a 10-year-old who spent too much time watching Mad Max and BMX Bandits. The hero of this post-apocalyptic adventure is the Kid, played by Monroe Chambers, a teenager struggling to survive in the ruins of an alternate 1997. The perpetually dry wasteland is ruled by the sadistic overlord Zeus, played by Michael Ironside, who liquidates, literally, his enemies. With the help of a mysterious girl named Apple, the Kid faces Zeus and his BMX-riding henchmen, led by the fearsome Skeletron. Turbo Kid is a nostalgic, albeit surprisingly gory, spoof of the weird and wonderful world of 80s pop culture, from bad synth-pop music to Michael Ironside to BMX bikes. Written and directed by Francois Simard, Anouk Wissel and Jan-Carl Wissel, Turbo Kid was filmed as a Canadian-New Zealand co-production. It premiered in 2015 at the Sundance Film Festival. It was released in August of that same year. I saw that at the Music Box.
Better than Ready Player One.
Oh, don't get crazy now. I'm a fan of Ready Player One. I think Ready Player One's pretty great.
All right.
Well, Olivia Cooke's in it, so that's
I love her too. You know?
No, I like that movie. I thought Ready Player One was pretty great. I did, and I liked all the references. I didn't get them all. I've seen it like four times, and every time I see it, you know, the War Boys are in that movie.
That they are.
Yeah. And I almost passed out when I saw them. I was like, that's not, first of all, that's not an 80s reference. The War Boys are in
there. I mean, there's a lot of references in there that are not 80s.
But as soon as I saw it was like one of those sweeping shots of like 8 million characters running, which is all over the place.
Yeah.
War Boys are right there center. I was like, look at the War, put the War Boys in there.
Yeah.
Speaking of Mad Max.
There you go.
So, all right. You know, we got a break. So everybody hang on. We'll come back and talk a little bit more about this. Wrap it up with some more of the great post-apocalyptic movies. And we want to hear from you at 312-981-7200. News is up next. All right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Skyline studio. We're here till 5 a.m. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, man, Triple Play Thursday. It's one artist, three songs. I'm a little more Allman Brothers right there. And coming up at 5, Steve Grzanich has the opening bell. Steve Cochran has your morning drive at 6. So make sure you stay tuned for that. We're going to wrap up the conversation here about post-apocalyptic movies. We've got some texts, and here's Trucker Rich. Hey, Rich.
Hey, good evening, Nick.
Hey.
One of the fun movies that, all right, I'm going to try to pronounce again, post-apocalyptic movies.
Yeah.
One of the fun ones was Damnation Alley.
Oh, Damnation Alley. Jan Michael Vincent, George Peppard.
Just because of that truck thing they had.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, some bad special effects from the giant scorpions were chasing him on that motorcycle.
And there were giant cockroaches, and there was like all kinds of crazy colors in the sky. That's a classic 70s movie. And I'll tell you something. I don't know if you heard, Rich, when Tom Appel was on, but he told me that the vehicle, or at least one of the vehicles that they used, because it was this weird truck vehicle that had like three tires that were all together, that were bound by another a sort of tire.
Like a triangle setup?
Yeah, exactly. And so Tom Appel told me that truck was sitting outside of like an old gas station, just sitting there outside of a part of California. And it was just, I don't know, somebody owned it, but they just left it sitting out there. So the Damnation Alley truck was just like abandoned and left at like an old gas station.
Yeah, I've heard that somebody's rescued it and has put it back together too, but I can't verify that.
Yeah, but it's a terrible movie, but it's classic. I saw it when I was 12 when that movie came out, so of course I loved it, and I thought it was the coolest. Yeah. And Jan Michael Vincent at that time in 1977, Jan Michael Vincent was like the coolest dude on the planet.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then a question. We didn't have Svengoolie. I think it was called Creature Features.
Yeah.
Back in the 60s, wasn't there a bunch of like, well, I know there was Hercules versus the Mole People and Hercules versus this and that.
Yeah.
I remember a bunch of like zombie Nazi movies. Like underwater.
Well, there's, okay, I can tell you.
Nazi zombies?
Well, there's a movie called Shockwaves, which is a great movie about, in fact, underwater Nazi zombies.
That's what it was.
And it's from 1976, maybe, and Peter Cushing's in it. Peter Cushing is he's in Shockwaves. And but it's sort of one of those legendary B movies because the plot is just so insane. The plot is about underwater Nazi zombies.
Yeah.
And so it's a crazy, crazy movie. And it's sort of one, I think Sven has showed that. I think Sven, I'm pretty sure Sven has showed it.
Yeah, I wish we could get Svengoolie out here where I live.
Yeah,
but it's not even on satellite.
No,
I don't know if you can get it online or not.
Well, you know, MeTV is now across the nation. So
right. Well, we don't have that on DirecTV yet.
Oh.
So
all right. Well, I guess you can get. I know that you can follow him online.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, and he's got a website. Svengoolie.com is his website. You should check it out. So, all right, Rich, have a good one. Take care, buddy. 312-981-7200 is the phone number.
With that Shockwaves movie, in terms of Nazi exploitation, is it better or worse than Ilsa She-Wolf of the SS?
Well, I mean, that's a whole different level.
That's true.
You know, this is much more accessible than Ilsa, if you want to talk about that kind of thing. But it's like, I'm assuming you saw the two Dead Snow movies.
Yeah, loved them.
Yeah. Dead Snow was inspired by Shockwaves.
All right.
There's no question about it. Dead Snow was inspired by Shockwaves.
I'm going to track that down.
Yeah. Yeah. Shockwaves is something, man. I'm trying to remember who directed it. Ken Wiederhorn is the first name that pops into my head. I think the director of that movie is Ken Wiederhorn. I'm not sure, but that's the name that's in my head. So,
yeah, it's Ken Wiederhorn.
Is it Ken Wiederhorn? All right. Yeah, no, it's sad.
How did you remember that?
I don't know. I'm
that's incredible.
I'm a loser. I don't know. But the director of Shockwaves is Ken Wiederhorn. I think he's directed a couple of other sort of popular B-70s movies. Yeah.
I get a kick out of it when Tom gets surprised about your encyclopedia-esque brain.
Yeah. why would anybody remember the name of the director of Shockwaves?
Get used to it, Tom.
I know. It's just, you know, I knew this going in. I knew this going in that things like this were going to happen. I just didn't know how deep it was going to go.
Yeah, when I can rattle off the name of the director of Shockwaves, something's wrong,
underwater man. Nazi zombies.
Yeah, directed by Ken Wiederhorn.
He also did, Return of the Living Dead Part 2.
Yes, he did. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I knew he had directed a couple of genre movies.
Ken Wiederhorn.
That's him, man. The legendary Ken Wiederhorn, if you will. 630 area code says, when I saw Beneath the Planet of the Apes at the Sky High Drive-In, my friend told me not to look at the part where they take their masks off. So at that part, I turned around, watched the other screen, and watched The Car with James Brolin. Now, have you ever seen The Car?
I have seen The Car.
That is a magnificently horrible movie.
It really is.
And I love it. I love that movie. The car is cool, too. The actual car. I mean, you know, very cool. 630 area code 12 Monkeys, of course.
Super good.
Great movie. Well, you know, that's when I got to meet Gilliam. He came to town to promote 12 Monkeys. I got to meet him, hung out with him for a while.
What is that even like to talk Amazing. To someone that? Because he's mad genius is really the only way I can describe him.
He's just ridiculous. He's unbelievable.
Oh, man.
Let's see. 815 mentions WALL-E. WALL-E is my favorite Pixar movie.
It is. You know, I haven't watched it in a long time, but I remember watching it and just, I don't know. It was tears, really.
Oh, it's a beautiful movie.
It's
beautiful.
Was it like the first half hour?
No,
really?
No dialogue.
No dialogue
except
all.
For, you know, the sounds that WALL-E
makes.
Yeah,
a little bit of that, but
and then it turns into brilliant social satire.
Yeah.
So not only is it a great post-apocalyptic science fiction movie, not only is it funny, like really, really funny, not only is it sweet and romantic because the romance between WALL-E and Eva is just beautiful. Voice work by Jeff Garlin and other great people. I love that movie. I love that movie, and it's absolutely my favorite Pixar movie. And all the Pixar movies make me cry. All of them do. I think that's one of the objectives of Pixar is to make you cry. Because I cried at Toy Story 3. I cried at WALL-E.
Well, you know, I mean, Toy Story 3.
When they're in the incinerator? Are you kidding me?
Yeah. Well, the best part is I always like those movies because the, what was it? The kid, Andy, was always roughly the age that I was.
Sure.
So when it gets to like, because when that's all about him going to college.
Right.
That came out right when I was going to college.
Well, it was
amazing.
It was, I mean, that made me cry. Oh my God, Inside Out. Oh my God.
That's great.
Lost my mind. And it's usually towards the end when you cry. But Pixar decided, hey, guess what? Why doesn't everybody go see Up so you can cry in the first 10 minutes of the movie? I was a wreck.
Traumatizing.
10 minutes into Up, I'm like, what did I just see? Coco, the last Pixar movie, cried.
It's amazing.
Pixar movies are great. They're awesome. They make you cry. But Up was just, I mean, that was just above and beyond you know, I mean, I could, I mean, you know, it's usually last 90, you know, you're 90 minutes into the movie, there's about 15 minutes left, you start crying. This is like, hi, we're going to open up the movie with this. Like, what? Sobbing. 10 minutes into Up, sobbing. Every time I watch it.
As you should be.
It's ridiculous. It's awesome. All right, let's finish this up real quick. The Road, Cormac McCarthy book. They made a really screwy movie out of it. I mean, it was...
It's Vigo. Almost unwatchable again.
Yeah.
Even though it's brilliant.
It is. Stalker, classic. Escape from New York comes in at number 3 on the list. And we also mentioned Escape from L.A. Planet of the Apes is considered the second greatest post-apocalyptic movie. And then, number 1 on this list is, of course, Mad Max and all of its sequels. And it's true, because all the Mad Max movies are amazing. The first one is great, even though it's, you know, I mean, you can get the actual Australian version, but for a long time, the only version that was available was the really badly dubbed version, where, like, Mel Gibson's voice is, "Hey, how you doing? I'm Mad Max." You know, it was...
Mrs. Higgins.
Yeah, Mrs. Higgins. But you can get the Australian version. They were like the you know, because that was a super low-budget movie that was picked up by a teeny, teeny distributor. And they were convinced that nobody would understand Australian accents. So they dubbed the whole movie really poorly with, like, weird voice choices. So, but you can get the original, and I highly recommend it. Even if you get the American version, it's still awesome.
Yeah.
The Road Warrior is one of the greatest movies ever made. Ever. I back Thunderdome. I know a lot of people don't. I back it. Even the kids, I don't care. I like the kids in it.
It's great.
The Thunderdome sequence alone is amazing. And of course, Tina Turner. Come on, man. And again, it climaxes like Road Warrior with this extended, like a crazy extended chase sequence. And then Fury Road goes without saying. Mad Max Fury Road goes without saying. It's a masterpiece. So there you go. There are some post-apocalyptic movies for you to check out. And now we're going to talk about some of the stories behind some famous product placements in movies and in TV and stuff like that. So product placement is what we're going to talk about. And I mentioned it earlier near the beginning of the show that I have one of the most ridiculous examples of product placement ever. And there are a lot of ridiculous examples of product placement, but this one involves the classic Bill Cosby movie, Leonard Part 6. I'm being facetious, by the way. But let's break here for some weather. For today, mostly sunny start with an increase in clouds, a chance of rain and scattered thunderstorms by the afternoon, warmer and more humid, high near 80. Scattered showers and storms will become more numerous overnight. For tomorrow, temps in the 40s near the lake, high near 50, warmer in the south. For Saturday, a high of 80 at O'Hare, cooler lakeshore, chance of evening and nighttime showers and thunderstorms with an overnight low of 60. And then Sunday, periods of rain and thunderstorms likely, high in the mid-70s. The rain will end overnight. The winds will diminish slightly and will get down to a low in the upper 50s. It's currently 61 at O'Hare, 61 degrees at Midway, 63 at the lakefront. Okay, so we'll take a break. When we come back, product placement is the topic. And if you want to jump in here with some of the more blatant or memorable uses of product placement in movies and TV, give us a call or a text at 312-981-7200. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN, live in the Allstate Skyline Studio. We are 18 stories above beautiful downtown Chicago here till 5. It's Thursday, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah, baby, Triple Play Thursday. That wraps up the Allman Brothers. We got time for one more, but it won't be a triple play because we only got two more breaks. So it'll be a two for Thursday for our last requests. 312-981-7200. Is the phone number if you would like to join us, talk or text. We're talking about some stories behind 10 famous product placements. You get to see product placements in a lot of stuff, in TV shows and in movies. And what are some of the more memorable ones? 312-981-7200. So we got some stories behind these product placement stories. And the first one is Junior Mints in Seinfeld. Who's going to turn down a Junior Mint? It's chocolate. It's peppermint. It's delicious. were truer words ever spoken, but it might not have been that way. Other candy companies were originally asked for permission to place their product in that episode. Not seeing the humor in having their bread and butter fall into the open chest cavity of a patient, Seinfeld was turned down by M&M's and Lifesavers, among others, before getting the Junior Mint people. No money exchanged hands between Tootsie Roll, which is Junior Mint's parent company, and Seinfeld. With the amount of product exposure Junior Mint's gained from that episode, it's quite a deal. And, yeah, so I love hearing these stories about how other places turned it down. So that's another M&M saying no. And by the way, the title of that episode is The Junior Mint. So not only is it mentioned in a major way, you know, referenced in a major way and, you know, as a product placement and also as a plot point to that episode, it's the title of the episode. The episode is called The Junior Mint. And speaking of M&M's, this is a legendary one that's been mentioned so many times. Reese's Pieces and E.T. Between Seinfeld and E.T., M&M's has truly missed some huge marketing opportunities, but not exactly like the company is hurting. The rumor is that Mars, Inc. Just didn't think this was a worthwhile movie on which to spend their advertising dollars, but no one has ever substantiated that fact. Whatever the reason is, it was a big mistake. Mars's competitor Hershey snapped up the opportunity to promote Reese's Pieces. Hershey's agreed to spend $1 million promoting E.T. in exchange for the rights to use E.T. in its ads. The payoff was huge. The delightful little peanut butter candies saw a reported 65% jump in profits just 2 weeks after E.T.'s premiere. 65% in 2 weeks.
That's madness.
And you know that guy who turned it down at M&M's fired.
Oh, 100%.
He might have been the same guy. Well, no, because it can't be the same guy. Junior Mints was many years later after E.T. Now, let me give you the example of what I was talking about. This horrendous movie called Leonard Part 6 that Bill Cosby made in the mid-80s. So bad, he told people not to see it. I saw it, and it is horrendous. It is a terrible, terrible movie. Almost worth seeing. It's one of those movies that's almost worth seeing because it's so unbelievably terrible. So in it, they do have Coca-Cola, but, you know, Bill Cosby was very, very closely associated with Coca-Cola, so you knew that that was going to be kind of a gag. And they do have Jell-O in it because Bill Cosby, you know, you got the Jell-O pudding and you got the Coke, you see, with Theo and pizza and goo. So you knew that those were going to be there. So there's one scene in the movie where his daughter plays a wannabe actress, and she's in this really terrible play that's in a small theater. And it's directed, I think if I remember correctly, the play itself, the director of the play within the movie was Moses Gunn, who I believe his daughter was having an affair with, and he's like 45 years her senior. That's one of the hilarious running gags in the movie. So he goes to see, Bill Cosby goes to see her daughter, his daughter in this horrific play, this terrible play, which is in a dumpy theater. And he wants to say hello to her, but the green room, the reception room is downstairs. So he's got to go down to this dank basement. And trust me, I did theater at the Factory Theater in Loyola, and trust me, green rooms in the dank basement exist. You trust me on this. Storefront theater, folks. So anyway, he goes down, he's walking down this long hallway, and he turns like a corner, and on a table, there's just like a round table set up on the outside of this room with like, if I remember, there was like a red background, like a red, the wallpaper or the paint on the wall behind it was red. But it was a table, okay? And like a grocery store display, perfectly stacked in a triangle form, were about 50 bars of Lava Soap. Now, Lava Soap, for people who don't know, Lava Soap, is that still around? Is Lava Soap still around?
Lava Soap. I'm more of an Irish Spring
guy. Well, Lava Soap was particularly important for like auto mechanics used Lava Soap. It was a very rough soap.
It is still around.
So you would use Lava Soap and or Goop if you worked like as a mechanic, or you would get oil or dirt in your hands. Goop was in a can and you would scoop it out, and that was like a hardcore soap. So for some reason, it's not explained. It's not mentioned. But right in the center of the thing is, like I said, a giant, beautifully stacked pyramid of what looks like a grocery store display of Lava Soap. And I'm like, what the? No mention of it. It's just in the shot, and it's in the shot for, like, every time they cut away, there it is. There's this beautiful, you know, grocery store display of Lava Soap in the basement of this crappy theater for absolutely no reason whatsoever. Now, I remember when I saw the movie, I'm like, what the hell is this display? I was working at the Jewels when that movie came out, and I'm like, that looks like one of my friends stacked it. Like, went to the basement of this crappy theater
and just stacked
and
the lava.
Stacked a bunch of Lava Soap so that it looked like a grocery display. And I remember watching the movie going, that's the most ridiculous and blatant product placement for absolutely no reason that I've ever seen in a movie. No explanation, no acknowledgement. It's just there in a bunch of different shots. Look at how beautiful this Lava Soap is. Now, subliminally, you're going to go out and buy some Lava Soap after seeing Leonard Part 6. Then, and you know what you're going to do with it? You're going to wash your eyes out because you just sat through Leonard Part 6. So, all right. That's the most. We have more stories behind product placements. And if you got anything, 312-981-7200. But the Lava Soap thing in Leonard Part 6 is the most ridiculous. All right. We'll be back. Sad we're only going to hear two songs now. Cheap Trick, one of my favorite bands of all time. Who requested the Cheap Trick?
That was Brad.
All right, Brad. Nice job.
Look at the big brain on Brad.
Big brain on Brad. All right. Yeah, Triple Play Thursday. Yeah. And we'll get one more Cheap Trick song before we get out of here. Welcome back, everybody. We are here until 5, and right now we're talking about some of the stories behind famous product placements. We told you about the background of Junior Mints and what happened with Reese's Pieces. And how both of those were big mistakes by the M&M's company. And here is Doc on WGN. Hey, Doc.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
Morning.
Another great show.
Thank you.
Hey, I got a good story on this one for you. The movie Murphy's Romance.
Sure.
With James Garner and Sally Field.
Yeah, yeah.
Kansas City has Casey Masterpiece barbecue sauce, and they made a deal for product placement. And the owner of the company was a psychiatrist from Kansas City, Rich Davis, and they'd send all these bottles out there, and the director looks at it, and he goes, it was a big scene where they're having a dance or a wedding or something out at the ranch, and he said, a farmer wouldn't have all those little bottles. And they'd send a bunch of gallons to catering and the food trucks,
uh-huh.
And he said, go get all those gallon jugs and spread those around on these tables. And that really set it off, and their sales just exploded after that.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. That's pretty amazing. The director of that movie, by the way, Martin Ritt, a terrific director, and obviously likes barbecue sauce.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you know, you think about it, a farmer wouldn't have messed with a bunch of little bottles.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's true. It's very, very true.
Know?
Yeah.
And he had the eye for it, and he just happened to have supplied the whole food trucks with it.
That's amazing. And I love Casey. I love Casey Masterpiece. I think it's great barbecue sauce.
Yeah, yeah, he sold them to Hunt's or Heinz or somebody years ago, but
sure.
still around.
Very cool. All right, Doc, thanks, buddy.
All right, man.
Have a good morning. All right, how about Ray-Ban and Risky Business? The Wayfarer, Ray-Ban.
Yeah.
I used to love that episode of Saved by the Bell with Zack Slater and Screech are home alone and they bust out some Risky Business-style moves wearing socks and using brooms as guitars. Anyway, back to Risky Business. At the time, Wayfarer sunglasses Tom Cruise modeled in that movie were pretty much biting the dust. Annual sales were only about 18,000. After Tom Cruise wore them in the movie and on the cover of the movie, in 1983, the sales skyrocketed to 360,000. By 1989, Ray-Ban had sold more than 4 million Wayfarer models. A bit of trivia, Audrey Hepburn wore Wayfarers in Breakfast at Tiffany. Don Johnson wore them in Miami Vice. Bruce Willis wore them in Moonlighting. And Tom Cruise tried them on again for Top Gun. Why such a wide gap between Audrey and the 80s revival? Well, in 1982, Ray-Ban inked a contract with a product placement company, $50,000 per year, to put Ray-Bans in movies and television. Now, here's a little story about that. They wanted Paul Brickman, who wrote and directed Risky Business, specifically wanted Wayfarers. He specifically wanted the Ray-Bans.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't, it was very, very difficult to get. So they used, sunglasses. They borrowed them from, after the Blues Brothers shoot. So the glasses that were used in Risky Business were used in Blues Brothers.
Really?
Yeah. So there's an, because they're both shot in Chicago. I don't know if the production left behind their Ray-Bans somewhere, but there's a connection. Paul Brickman talks about it on the DVD commentary of Risky Business.
Well, it's just so weird to think of those glasses as ever being obsolete.
Yeah.
Or out of style. I mean,
you know, listen, man, in the 80s, they were everywhere.
I love the Wayfarers.
Everywhere, man. How about this one? FedEx and Castaway.
Oh, man.
You can't escape the product placement of FedEx and Castaway. It's literally everywhere. You know, a lot of Robert Zemeckis movies have product placement.
Hey, he's looking out for his wallet there.
It's literally everywhere, and what great publicity when FedEx manager Chuck Nolan washes up on a deserted island. He collects all the FedEx boxes that wash up with him while he ends up opening most of them to aid his survival on the island. He leaves one unopened and returns it to its rightful owner many years later. CEO Fred Smith even had a cameo in the movie. And what did FedEx pay for all this? Absolutely nothing. They were reluctant to allow their image and brand to be used at first. The plane crash scene really bothered them. You think?
you know how they don't put plane crash scenes in the airplane versions of movies?
Yeah.
That's got to be a really weird moment because all of a sudden this guy just winds up on an island.
But ultimately they decided that the movie had a good message and brand awareness, and they said it would be worth it. And, and it turned out to be absolutely worth it. But, yeah, I could see them being concerned about the plane crash.
Sure.
I could see it. It's like, listen, FedEx is a great company, except their pilots are really
Your package might wind up, that volleyball you ordered.
Yeah.
Some guy's going to turn it into his best pal.
Wilson.
Every time, I live near the Wilson stop, and every time I get off the red line, I think to myself,
oh, Wilson.
Wilson.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Reebok, Jerry Maguire. This one should be titled When Product Placement Goes Bad. If you think back hard enough, you will remember that Cuba Gooding Jr.'s character, Rod Tidwell, held a grudge against Reebok for the entire movie because Reebok wouldn't use him in their ads. Reebok provided more than $1.5 million in merchandise, ads, and promotional materials to be featured in the movie because they thought the ending of the movie would be a little different. Over the closing credits, a fake Reebok commercial was supposed to be shown with Reebok saying, "Rod Tidwell, we ignored you for years. We were wrong. We are sorry." However, the scene got cut, so Reebok ended up investing $1.5 million to have their brand disparaged for a couple of hours. They sued TriStar Pictures and settled out of court for an undisclosed amount. I never knew that.
That's rough.
How about this? White Castle and Harold and Kumar go to White Castle. It's the best. That's the best 90-minute commercial for White Castle that you can possibly.
Pretty much.
Because when they finally get to the White Castle, and that scene where they're eating it's one of the greatest food eating scenes of all time.
And you want the White Castle.
No, you want it immediately. When you're watching those guys eat those skinny, it's like, man, I got to have a slider right now. It's like one of the greatest commercials that you could possibly have.
I'm pretty sure I didn't know what White Castle was until I saw Harold and Kumar go to White Castle.
That's another thing, is that, they're not in every state. White Castle's, we got them. We're lucky enough to have White Castles here, in Chicago because they're awesome. But they're not available. So there were a lot of people that had no idea. There were a lot of people in different parts of the country who were like, what the hell is a White Castle? So they got all kinds of exposure on this one. Because they're regional.
A lot of White Castles opened up.
Yeah. Let's see. I love Harold and Kumar. White Castle is okay, they said. Because of its national recognition, Krispy Kreme was also approached to play a role in the movie. Krispy Kreme was not thrilled by the idea of the brand being so closely associated with a Cheech and Chong-esque movie and turned them down. White Castle had no qualms. Of course they didn't. Of course they didn't. White Castle's customers, 80% of them are drunk. They get most of their business after 2 o'clock when the bars close.
Yeah.
Seriously.
I mean,
there were very rare opportunities, very, very rare times during my adulthood when I was sober at White Castle. It was mostly, I'm not kidding. I'm not joking
around.
It was mostly like, I'm at the bar. And here's the thing. I spent a significant amount of time over there on Elston where the Factory Theater used to be. And so the Factory Theater used to be over on Elston. And, south of Kedzie and Addison. And so We would have rehearsals, and we would have do performances of shows and stuff like that, and then we'd immediately go across the street to Chief O'Neill's, and we get hammered. We go to Chief O'Neill's and we get drunk, and what's within walking distance of Chief O'Neill's? White Castle. Addison, Kedzie, and Elston, right there. Addison and Kedzie. That's the one I grew up going to, because I lived in Addison and Ravenswood, so the one that I used to go to when I was a kid was that one. And I can't tell you the number of times after partying with the Factory Theater people that we'd end up at White Castle.
Yeah. It was kind of a game changer when I found out that Uber Eats delivers White Castle.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. So, White Castle had no qualms about being featured, and they even agreed to promote the film with collectible cups, radio ads, and signage. They didn't pay a dime for product placement, however. Well, they didn't have to. I mean, it was the best commercial they ever had. Staples for The Office. Any fan of The Office knows that Staples is Dunder Mifflin's biggest competition. It's not just a mere coincidence. The Office has product placement deals with Staples, Hewlett-Packard, and Activision's Call of Duty computer game, among others. But the Staples deal is undoubtedly one that is referenced the most. Not only is the brand mentioned as DM's biggest competitor, but Staples products are shown in virtually every episode. Look closely the next time you watch, and you could find anything from Staples brand CDs, Staples brand fax paper, Staples shredder, or even an integral part of one episode where Kevin demonstrates the power of the shredder by using it to make a salad. The writer says, while I wasn't able to find much Staples coughs up to be featured prominently in the show, it's clear that they had a very proud affiliation. When one episode features Dwight quitting his job at Staples to return to Dunder Mifflin, Staples released this memo: the company has a sense of humor. You might want to buy pens there. So, okay. More product placement stories. We got a break here for some weather. So if you guys have any product placement examples and things like that, 312-981-7200. Right. Closing out Triple Play Thursday with the great band Cheap Trick, Rockford Zone. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Coming up, Steve Grzanich with the opening bell. Also coming up, the stories that matter with Vic Vaughn and the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. And also, I will be doing my weekly visit with the Cochrane Gang this morning at 6:20. We'll preview some of the stuff that's happening this weekend and talk about movies and things like that, as we do almost every Thursday. So that'll be at 6:20. So make sure you tune in for that. All right, we've been talking about product placements and the stories behind some of the most famous product placement. And we got some people on the line. Here's Mike on WGN. Hey, Mike.
Hey, good morning, Nick. How are you doing?
All right, man, what's up?
Back in the 80s, I took my kids to see Goonies, and it was a movie. I detested it, but they loved it.
Yeah.
And it was just such blatant product placement. I said, geez, they got the kids posing, so they actually showing, whatever product they were holding, especially when we went to the convenience store scene and something like that.
Now, see, I hated the Goonies as well, Mike.
Yeah.
It's a terrible movie, so I don't remember the product placement because I only saw it the one time 30-something years ago. So.
Well, that's same here.
Yeah.
I had little kids at the time, and
sure.
That was what they loved.
Yeah, so I don't even, do you remember any of the products?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
I don't blame you, but I'm not surprised by that. I'm not surprised that there was blatant, ridiculous public or product placement in that movie. So,
yeah.
All right. All right, Mike. All right, thanks, man. Take care. Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing about having kids. Every once in a while, you're going to have to sit through some movies that are absolutely terrible. That's okay. Here's Brian on WGN. Hi, Brian.
Hey, good morning, Nick.
Hey.
Milton Swing Line Red Stapler
now,
Office Space.
Now, you know what, Brian? They did not have a red stapler. The company...
Yeah, yeah.
They
just about to say that, yeah.
Yeah, they didn't have a red stapler. After Office Space became, a cult hit, Swing Line made a red stapler. They actually started manufacturing, and they sold like hotcakes.
Yeah, multiple colors. Yeah, they sold them in the colors of the rainbow,
yeah.
I thought that was funny.
That's pretty great. That's pretty great, especially for a movie that was considered a massive flop, but then, of course, became a big, big, a big hit.
Every time I see that actor, I play Milton. I always think of Office Space.
That's Steve Root. Stephen Root. He's on. Okay. Stephen Root. I don't know, Brian. If you should be watching Barry, because he's on there with Bill Hader and he's unbelievable on it. He's great.
Right. That's the second time you recommended it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to check that out.
Okay. All right, Brian. Thanks, man.
All right, brother.
Yeah, Stephen Root. Stephen Root is amazing. I love that guy. He's great in everything. Great in everything. We mentioned Idiocracy earlier. He's hilarious in Idiocracy.
Yeah. I recently had to, well, didn't have to, but I watched Life of the Party, that Melissa McCarthy, and he's in it for like a minute playing her dad.
Yeah.
And he's just screaming, and it's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you watch that movie?
I was on HBO, and I was like, you know, I like Melissa McCarthy enough, and I thought, what's the Rodney Dangerfield movie that's a remake of, basically?
Back to School.
Back to School, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, there were bits that were pretty good, specifically Stephen Root screaming about something.
Back to School I like very much, but I'm an Easy Money guy. I think Easy Money is funnier, and I know that's the unpopular choice. Everybody loves Back to School, and I love Back to School. I think Back to School is very funny, but if I'm going to choose a Rodney movie, 9 times out of 10, I'm going Easy Money.
All right.
Also, Joe Pesci, unbelievably hilarious in that movie. Oh, and his name is Nicky. Hey, Nicky, look! Oh, Nicky, look out! Nicky, take it easy. There's one. No, that movie is. I think that movie is unbelievably funny. Okay, we got back to product placement. By the way, you know, it's not just Junior Mints in Seinfeld. Seinfeld has a ton of product placements. Like, and not just that, they also have the O. Henry bar. That's a big product placement. And all of the, you know, because, you know, a lot of the episodes, well, you know, 90% of the episodes take place in Jerry's, you know, for the most part in Jerry's apartment, or good portions of each episode take place in Jerry's apartment. And there are real products in his refrigerator. I distinctively remember that they at one point when it was hot, they were drinking Clearly Canadian. You guys remember Clearly Canadian flavored soda water? That was very, very popular in the early 90s, and there were several episodes where they were chugging down the Clearly Canadian. So they had real products, you know, Jerry on his shelves and in his cabinets. Those were real products. You had the O. Henry. Not only that, but you know all those other products that they mention, and I'm trying to think of some of the other ones because there are a lot more. That they used in Seinfeld.
Wasn't there one with like a sponge or something, or
the Today sponge? That's made up.
Oh,
I thought there was no brand, or at least I don't know. Maybe because I thought, you know, I mean, obviously the idea was that, you know, that was Elaine's preferred choice of birth control was the sponge, and they called it in the show. It was called the Today sponge. So. Let's see. Here is Colleen on WGN. Hi, Colleen.
Hey,
hi.
I was just wondering if you remembered that commercial from Super Bowl when he finally delivered that FedEx package and it had like a two-way radio and a compass and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that. That's right.
Yeah, that was hysterical. That was a great commercial. And he's standing there looking like, oh, my God, I could have used all this stuff.
Yeah, that's so I totally forgot about it. Thank you for reminding me of that, Colleen, because that's hilarious.
It was. It was pretty funny.
That's great.
All right, Nick, you guys take care.
All right, you too. See ya. Yeah. You know, Seinfeld, by the way, here's another thing that I find Seinfeld fascinating about the set of Seinfeld, in addition to, you know, having real products that are getting, you know, unintentional plugs. He's got a shelf in his dining room area, you know, his living room, dining room area, right behind his dining room table, where he's got VHS tapes. So here's what I've noticed that he has. For some reason, Jerry Seinfeld's character has Child's Play 2. Don't know why, but he's got Child's Play 2. And because I keep looking in the, every time I watch, and everybody knows, I've seen every episode of Seinfeld like 900 times. So I look in the background now to see what the videotapes are. And he's got Child's Play 2, Hunt for Red October, and he's two copies, and I'm not making this up, two copies of True Colors with James Spader and John Cusack. a political drama that bombed at the box office massively on Jerry Seinfeld's shelf in the background. If you watch it, two copies of True Colors.
True Colors.
You have to have two copies of the James Spader, John Cusack drama, True Colors.
Oh, of course.
But I love that he has Child's Play 2, not Child's Play. Like, he's got Child's Play 2. Here's Bob on WGN. Hey, Bob.
Yeah, morning.
Morning.
Thanks for taking my call. You obviously forgot that on those same shelves, there's a small statuette of Superman sitting there.
Well, there's
he was a big fan of that.
There's a Superman in every episode of Seinfeld. There is some some sort of representative of Superman in every single episode of Seinfeld. And he is upset. Jerry Seinfeld in real life is a massive Superman fan. He's a big comic book guy. There are tons of references to Superman. You know, at one point when a guy that he went to high school with resurfaces and challenges him to a race because he thought
he was
faster, they play the theme from Superman at the end, and he keeps referring to his girlfriend as Lois Lane. Tons of it. But yeah, you're right, Bob. There's a little statue. There's also a magnet on his refrigerator. There is a mention or at least in the background, there is an image of Superman in every episode of Seinfeld.
Well, do you remember he had the lady who played Lois on Lois and Clark on the show for a little while?
Yeah, Terry Hatcher. She's the one that they thought her boobs were fake. They're real and they're spectacular. That's Terry Hatcher. Yeah. All right, Bob, I got to run.
Okay.
Take care. And then, of course, very quickly, they made a deal with a Slinky, Etch-A-Sketch, and Mr. Potato Head for Toy Story. And then in Wayne's World, when they did It was Wayne's World. Okay, I'm not a big fan. I don't like Wayne's World very much. But I got to admit that whole sequence of product placement was really funny.
Little yellow, different.
Yeah. We got to take a break. By the way, coming up on tomorrow's show, the cast of Down in Front. It's a Down in Front podcast. And we'll tell you all about that. Plus, we'll have all the regular Friday features.